I can be a winning Ryder Cup captain away, so it is an exceptionally big deal, and it adds a lot to my legacy.
For the best Ryder Cup build-up reaction and exclusive interviews, go to otbsports.com/golfweekly and become an official friend of the pod now.
OTB AM with Gillette. Put your best face forward with our new and improved razors.
Bang on 7:30, and you're very welcome along to OTB AM. It's Gerry Gilroy and Shane Hannan with you this morning. Shane, good morning to you. How are you?
Morning, Gerald. Good, yourself?
I'm very well. There's a lot for us to get stuck into. We have a very busy show, loads of Gaelic football coming your way. Going to speak to two All-Ireland winners, Vicky Wall and Conor Myler, a little bit later on in the programme. We're going to speak with Paul Howard about his latest book and maybe see how happy he is about the start that Liverpool have made to the season. Plenty more coming your way as well. Dermot Corrigan's going to talk to us about the start of the season in Spain, and we'll get into a little bit of the back and forth about whether or not Leo Messi is going to be a bust at Paris Saint-Germain, because, you know, I mean, we like to overreact in this show to a lot of stuff, and Messi being subbed off the other night was one of those things. But the other thing that we liked to overreact to last week, which you're clearly feeling a little bit sore about, was Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, and he's back, baby, was essentially the message that we got this morning in our pre-show production meeting. Screw you, was what I heard you say.
Basically, like yourself and Nathan gave me a little bit of a hard time. I'm well able to take it, but it was veiled digs at Ole Gunnar Solskjaer and Manchester United, and I think it typified and summarised the lack of patience that there is around football fans at the moment. We all want success immediately, and there's a manager like Ole Gunnar Solskjaer doing good things at United, changing the ethos of the club, bringing in some pretty decent signings, it has to be said, and improving the attitude around the club amongst the fans, and one defeat against Young Boys, and it's a disaster. And we saw how quickly things can change for even footballers, because Jesse Lingard, everyone is like, look, this mistake against Young Boys, this is exactly what he does. This is his United career in a nutshell. The West Ham loan was just a complete chance, and then he does what he does at the weekend and scores an absolute stunning winner against West Ham. So Football is fickle, Jerry. I think I said that last week as well. But I think someone like Solskjaer deserves, as I said last week, off the back of the Young Boys defeat, deserves time. And the West Ham win and the manner of it was very Fergie-esque, let's just say.
Okay, so that's the bit that you're leading on here, is that there are parallels with the Ferguson era, the beginning of it. I mean, we did have this exact same conversation last week where we were like, yeah, but Ferguson had a track record of being successful.
Yeah. But that's fair. That is absolutely fair. And as I said, Solskjaer needs... He's still in the dock among many fans.
Tell me about that. Tell me what... Amongst your brethren, your Manchester United brethren, what is the level of patience there? Because ultimately, that's what's important, right?
I honestly think that amongst the match-going Manchester United fan, the fans that buy their tickets, and even the Irish fans who maybe go over whenever they can, 2, 3, 4 times a year, whatever it is, they are firmly behind Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. Now, I'm not speaking for all of them here, but I get this feeling, and it's something that permeates through football and football fandom, that a lot of the fans that want his head on a plate are the fans behind a keyboard, who really are United fans in all but name, in name really alone, because they don't attend matches, they don't really put their money where their mouth is and go to games and support their club in ways that the club needs support, perhaps. But Those are the fans that often pipe up and want a manager's head suddenly. Because
is this not a weird form of some kind of football cultural apartheid, where the only football fans whose views matter are the ones who go to matches, as opposed to the ones who don't have the opportunity to go to matches either through geographical distance or financial reasons? Is there not something weird, kind of hierarchical, kind of like slightly colonial, in that I am entitled to my view and it's more important than your view because I am giving more money to the club than you are in person, as opposed to, like, you know, is there not something a bit weird about that? Like,
it's a very soccer thing, I'll grant you that, but it's something that I don't clearly all fans are equal, we're all equal, we all have a say, we all have an opinion, but It's the fans behind the keyboard that just voice and voice and voice without any real logic. I mean, wanting Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's head, I get the feeling that when you're at a match, when you're at Old Trafford, there's a very positive vibe. Like, even amongst the travelling supporters at the London Stadium at the weekend, there would have been quite a positive vibe heading into that game. Down on the train from Manchester to London, You know, people flying over from Ireland into to Heathrow to attend that game. And it is just an online thing. Now, I'm not saying some of those fans online who want Solskjaer's head in a plate don't also attend games. I'm sure some of them do. But it just seems to be a thing that people get abuse on. Like, I don't think Ole Gunnar Solskjaer cared about what was said about him last week. He's been through it before. I'm not saying Solskjaer is the answer, as I've said before, but he knows the club. He's been around the club for decades, and he's clearly doing something that the fans are latching onto. And more importantly, I think, I mean, we talk about what the fans care about, but the players are latching onto it. Look at the reaction at the weekend when Solskjaer ran on to hug David De Gea. The players were just buzzing to see those scenes. There's something happening at Manchester United right now. I'm not saying they're going to win the league this year. Liverpool and Chelsea are clearly the favourites still, but... Okay. There's a wave of positive emotion, I think.
It's interesting to me that you're not saying you think they're going to win the league, because that is a built-in acceptance that they actually don't have to win the league for Solskjaer to keep his job and for you to still feel relatively positive about the direction that they're going in. And I'm not putting words in your mouth here, but in the past, for example, when managers' time was coming to an end, there would have been, he must win something immediately. And there is definitely a sense that Solskjaer needs to win a trophy, and that if they go out of the Champions League, then I think all bets are off, right?
Yeah, and look, he does need a trophy, to be fair. I actually think they have a better chance of winning the Champions League this season than the Premier League, funnily enough. And that seems like a strange thing to say, given that they've lost to Young Boys in the opening game, but they will get through their group. They'll most likely top their group. Their next two games are home to Villarreal and Atalanta, both games that they should win at home.
I'm not giving them anything just yet. From a European football perspective, I'm not giving them anything just yet. Because, like, look at the weekend. It could have gone either way, right? You know, I'm not guaranteeing them that just yet. So, so you want them to win a trophy, but you don't feel they actually need to. This is the interesting bit for me, is that you've got a weird extra loyalty to Solskjaer because of who he is, because of his Manchester United tradition, as opposed to the qualities he has shown as a manager. And that's fine. Like, that's actually the whole point of being a fan. I think the whole point of being a fan is that you have a supporter more than a fan, rather. Like, and there's a subtle enough difference there in that you will support the club, you will support the team through thick and thin, and you will be there for them when things aren't going well. It's not to say you're not critical, but it's that bit that, like, you're going to give him that extra season, that extra 18 months than you would have done if Mourinho was producing what the results that Solskjaer has produced, because the football is clearly better under Solskjaer, or certainly more enjoyable.
Yeah, and look, I'm not stupid. I know that my ability and desire to give Ole Gunnar Solskjaer 18 months to do this is not going to actually happen. He's not going to get that time, because if United do finish third or even fourth this season, he is going to probably get the sack, especially if they go out of the Champions League early. Well,
Champions League is all dependent. But if they reach the quarterfinals and finish third, and it's a close run thing, and they compete in an FA Cup final, I think he gets another season. And if he gets another season, and you know, at that point, the next two transfer windows are incredibly important to see if they can get a six and maybe a ball playing goalkeeper and get De Gea off the wage bill. If he's particularly playing as well as he continues to do, that might be a good thing. So I don't know. It's a very interesting period of time. One of the reasons we were talking about this is that you are going to be one of those match goers again. So that's why you feel that hierarchy. You're part of the in crowd. You're one of the cool ones who gets to go and support the team. And that hierarchy definitely exists, right? That's a real thing. You guys do look down on those people who are just behind the keyboards.
Not at all, because I'd say it's more a case of the local fans look down on perhaps the globalisation of Manchester United and maybe resented a little
Ireland
bit.
Ireland don't count. We're not. We've always been going to those games, though. We're not part of that.
No. But I remember standing in the Bishop Blaise pub in the shadow of Old Trafford a few years ago. I think it was the Sevilla game where United were knocked out of the Champions League. Terrible night. But before the game, there's a real antipathy towards half and half scarves, which I totally understand. I walked into the pub and, you know, you're surrounded by hundreds of fellow United fans chanting away. And I was wearing a half United, half Irish tricolour scarf. It said Irish Reds on it. And clearly the Irishness runs through the fabric of Manchester United Football Club. But this local woman, this Manc woman, came up to me and screamed in my face saying no half and half scarves. And I tried to explain to her in vain that it was actually my country and it wasn't half United, half Sevilla, but no, not having any of it. Now, she eventually left me alone to my can of Stella to try and enjoy the pre-match experience. But that's there's a lot of, I guess, local pride that maybe despises.
How did that make you feel, Shane?
I felt about 2 inches tall, Ger, I'm not going to lie. But it was one of those things, like, I'm looking forward to that. Like I'm heading over to the we're doing a double header, myself, my dad, my brother, at the Villarreal Champions League game, followed by the Everton game in the league a few days later, and then 2 weeks later going to the Atalanta game in the Champions League. So I've never, ever been more excited about heading over to a match. And I know I'm lucky. I don't think there's a turn your nose down at people who can't go to games. It's a very lucky position to be in, to be able to go over and travel across the water to watch your favourite team. I know a lot of people don't get the chance or don't have the time to do it or whatever it might be, but the match day experience is something I'm absolutely just clutching for at the moment. It's something we're all clutching for, I think, and people have clearly been going back to games over the last month or two, and it's something. Whetted, I know we spoke in the pre-show meeting about this Wright Thompson piece. So this is a piece that, like, it's not often I'll recommend a piece of sports writing so highly, but this is a piece Wright Thompson wrote in ESPN. If anyone's not familiar with him, he's based in Mississippi. He looks exactly like you'd expect someone called Wright Thompson to look, by the way. But he's written an absolutely extraordinary piece titled Super League Rage, Ronaldo Mania, and the Fight for the Soul of Manchester United. But Jesus, Jared, it's got my appetite whetted for a match day, let me tell you. A lot of people will be familiar with his writing, but...
Oh yeah, like everybody in Ireland lost their shit when he described Crumlin as the projects. and made a few small errors about stuff. It was like, oh, no, cannot have him. He came here and made a mistake about us. But actually, he's an absolute genius when it comes to writing. And this piece seems to at least acknowledge the fact that Manchester United, in signing Ronaldo, for example, have bought a troubled legacy, which Man United fans have essentially forgotten straight away because of the goal. It's like, oh yeah, absolutely, happy days. Give me my number 7 shot.
Yeah, it's a fingers in the air kind of thing, and I think a lot of United fans and football fans generally, anyone with a conscience really, feels a little bit uneasy about the whole thing. But Wright Thompson touches on it very delicately, the whole Catherine Mayorga stuff, the Super League stuff, the local fans being priced out by the globalisation, and he makes the point, you know, this Super League conversation is not going away. This is going to come back at some point in some form. But he touches on all those topics, those awkward topics for United fans, and deals with them in a way that I think someone from inside couldn't really write about. Like, he's coming in from Mississippi and writing about this stuff with no bias towards United, really.
He seems to be a United fan.
He seems to be, and he certainly has friends in Manchester. But his words summed up the emotion over the match day experience like nothing I've ever read. There's a paragraph I have in front of me here. It's very short, and he says, "I love big game days. This constant adding of people, everyone full of joy, looking at watches. The coming storm so powerful that not even this calm is truly calm. Or half pints of bitter and lager arrived." And he's in a pub with a woman called Carmel and her family. He says, "I caught Carmel smiling and shaking her head in wonder and joy at this family moment, this gathering of friends, old and new, worlds colliding, the coming football match, the excuse rather than the thing." And like, he's interviewed different people. He's interviewed someone from the FC United of Manchester club, the breakaway club, when the whole Glazer thing erupted. He's interviewed Nobby Stiles' son, John, and some really interesting insights into Nobby Stiles' life, by the way, as well. Brian Kidd is another person who he speaks with. And just the Irishness around the club as well. He says, "For generations, the club dispatched scouts into the churches and schools. Nearly every single person who lived in this part of the city was Catholic. Nearly all of them were Irish." And he says, "There were 2 and 3 generations into a new home. They were caught between the island of their past and the city of their future. No longer Irish, but not really English. Families all intermarried, stripped of the sturdy markings of home. And about the only thing that bound people together was their love of the Reds." Really, really interesting piece, and I'd urge any United fan or any football fan really to seek it out, because he talks about that game. He went to that match, Ronaldo's first game against Newcastle, talks about the atmosphere, and he says he walked into the stadium with a young friend of his, and he says he noticed a smell, and he wasn't quite sure what the smell was, and he eventually realised it was the smell of cut grass, that their tickets were so close to the pitch, he had forgotten what attending a match was like and what this experience felt like. So really, really interesting piece, and certainly something that would whet your appetite.
So you went and bought 3 tickets. You were like, "I'll get me tickets."
Yeah, I got carried away, a little bit carried away.
Is it easy enough to get tickets as a Man United fan? I presume you have to be a member of a supporters club, or are you getting them on the website?
You can get them on the website if you're I am a member of the club, but they are really, really hard to come by. Like the Newcastle tickets were the hardest tickets to get for a long, long time.
Well, once Ronaldo signed, unless you're Paddy Andrews and got them months and months in advance, it was like, ah, sure, look, there'll be nothing on that day, will there?
See, this is the thing. You have to plan ahead. Like, the Champions League tickets are a little bit easier, obviously, midweek. But the Everton game, I don't want to even say what I paid for the tickets for the Everton game. It wasn't anywhere near what some fans are lumping out.
So not face value. You had to pay over face value to get tickets for the Everton game.
Yeah, had to. The Premier League games, the home games at the moment. Now, there might be some fans listening who managed to get in early and get them
right
for face value price. But no, I wasn't. Sadly, it wasn't one of them. It's very difficult. Like, we're not Man City fans. You know, there aren't empty stadiums that we can, you know, like Wycombe Wanderers against Man City tonight at the Etihad. I mean, I shudder to think how little fans are going to be at that game. And Pep is, you know, brought on the wrath of Man City fans by coming out and saying it, which, you know, you can kind of see both sides, to be honest. It's not nice seeing your stadium half empty.
It's great how we started this conversation about Manchester United and somehow you've managed to flex on City. It's like the ultimate fan experience for people listening. It's like, oh, okay, I see that Shane is actually a dyed-in-the-wool Manchester United fan. Not just somebody who loves his own team, but who properly, actively hates on Man City at every available opportunity.
Well, you see, United fans actually have a chant that goes something like, the city is yours, the city is yours, 20,000 empty seats, are you effing sure? Which is quite an honest and open dig at Man City fans. But Pep said it himself. I don't think Pep would have said it if he didn't think
it was
an issue.
No, he's right. They need to, the fan base needs to be active and they need to come to games. But it'll take time. And luckily, they have a team that's worth it. Two quick comments before we get into our first piece with Vicky Wall. Peter says, if a manager doesn't win the league with that squad, it's a failure. If Tuchel, Pep or Klopp were managing United, the expectation would be that they win the league. That tells you all you need to know. I agree that those managers would be more likely to win the league with this squad than Solskjaer, but there is something complicated about having a club legend manage the team at this particular moment for the owners, who need to buy back some kind of love from the fans. So the owners have said that they want to grow the value of the club to 10 billion. And maybe at that point they'll sell it, or maybe at that point it'll be pushing off a billion in cash every year. And that's the whole point of trying to create an asset that's worth 10 billion. So they don't want to upset the local fan base, who, as we saw, can stop a game. Literally, they can stop the games if they want to, as they did last year. So I think that complicates things. And then the other thing is that maybe Solskjaer becomes a great manager over the next 18 months and they do give him the transfer window to get a defensive midfielder that transforms the team. I don't know. But I don't think you can just sub in. They've tried subbing in famous, qualified managers and it hasn't worked for them. And I'm not saying they got the recruitment right, but there is something complicated about the fact that they've gone to a club legend and invested the time and effort in getting him to this point, which means I don't think that they're going to rip him off.
Solskjaer feels to me, like, to bring it into an Irish perspective, Solskjaer feels to me like the Stephen Kenny, the person that some people are getting a little bit fed up of, but that is, to other fans, changing the way we're playing football and making us feel positive about the team again. Whereas the Moyeses and the Mourinhos and the Van Hals were maybe some previous managers that weren't bringing success, weren't playing the style of football that fans come to expect. Similarly to Stephen Kenny, Solskjaer deserves the exact same kind of time to do things. People might say he's had 3 years. Where are the trophies? That's a fair point. And trophies do need to happen in Manchester United, and they need to happen quite quickly. But yeah, I think 12 to 18 months is more than enough time for him to turn this team around. And as like you said, look, I agree with the commenter. With that squad, you need to be winning trophies. That is a fair point.
All right. I think we've been very gentle with you so far this morning, Shane. Our commenters won't be. It's 7:49. OTBAM is brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. Vicky Wall, All-Ireland football winner with Meath, coming up in just a moment. We're bringing the sports pages at 8:05. Conor Myler, one of the candidates for Footballer of the Year. We're going to talk to him at 8:20 this morning. We've got Dermot Corrigan going to talk to us about the situation in Spain and also what's going on with Leo Messi. And then Paul Howard is going to join us to talk to us about the latest escapades from Russell Carroll Kelly. And then we'll bring him on to Net Rugby at 9:30. But at 7:50 this morning, here is Meath's Vicky Wall talking to Tommy Rooney.
All right, I'm delighted to welcome the PWC GPA Women's Player of the Month Award for Ladies Football in September. Vicky Wall, congratulations on your award and congratulations on the success of the last couple of weeks. You brought the pride back to Meath football.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been unbelievable. It's been a very, very enjoyable few weeks. You know, we haven't got the cup yet, but so it'll be an excuse now to do a bit more celebrating when we get that. But yeah, it's been unbelievable.
I can't imagine you'll need much excuses looking at the Instagram celebrations over the last wee while. Can you let us in a wee bit on what those celebrations are like? Is it just pure mayhem? Is it heaven? Is it tough on the body? Are you able to enjoy it at all? Or is it just madness?
Yeah, I suppose looking back at it last week, a few days definitely merged into one. But we, like I said, we made the most of it and it was nice. We kind of got a mix of a few evenings with kind of, let's say, our families and friends and stuff like that. And then a few with just the team. So it's always special. And I know there's a few moments when we were on the bus that was kind of bringing us around to different clubs and stuff like that. We just kind of pause and look at each other and be like, best days of our lives. And it was just like, it was the best days of our lives. It was unbelievable. So yeah, it was class.
Can we go back to the final whistle at the end of the game? You were on off the ball speaking in a few days afterwards and there was that brilliant video of you. I think you're looking for your dad and you come across Sean Boylan conveniently just in front of the cameras. So you've got that iconic video for the rest of your life there with Sean Boylan. Being from Dunboyne, that must have been pretty special.
Yeah, absolutely. I suppose Sean's been very good to our ladies, even Dunboyne and even me, usually like any injuries you have or anything like that, if you're rushing to get back for a match, you know, he'll see you at any time of the day and he's just an absolute gent. So to see him after the match was unbelievable. And then obviously, yeah, I kind of maybe pawned him off a bit quickly and I was just looking for my dad. But I suppose it's such a nice memory to have. Yeah, absolutely.
When you were growing up, the keep-back jerseys, the Meath All-Ireland titles, like, was that a big fixture in your house?
Probably not, to be honest, no. Like, it's only since myself and my younger sister Sarah got involved in GAA, like, dad would have been soccer and my mum would have been involved in Irish dancing. So there probably wouldn't have been a huge amount of kind of maybe memories of that from when I'm younger. But yeah, it's been unbelievable. And I suppose keep back on the jerseys is always nice.
Mm. When did you, like, in terms of a footballer, the style that you play, it's quite unique in terms of, or maybe it was just the role that was there the day of the game against Dublin. You were the get-out clause all day long. Like, Meath's defensive system, the way that Eamon Murray had set you up in that game, it was phenomenal. It was actually quite similar to how Tyrone, I suppose, had stopped Kerry around that same week. We knew that Kerry wanted to score goals that day, and Tyrone's defensive shape around the D, the way that they stopped players one-on-one, and it was replicated just the same way by the Meath footballers the following week, the way you did against Dublin. But I suppose what Tyrone had a little differently is they maybe had a couple of different ways to get back up the field, whereas you were the cannonball coming out with the ball all the time. Did you know that was going to be your role that day, or did you just put the bit between the teeth and go with it as the game was transpiring?
Yeah, I think you kind of, like, obviously, like, I do like carrying the ball and stuff like that. So I suppose it's kind of maybe the position I was playing in the day, I was on a bit more ball and kind of, yeah, like you say, trying to break those lines. It's something that we would have acknowledged from the Cork game, that, like, it's something that we probably did a bit too slowly. We kind of let them get on top of us a bit too much, and, you know, they're a serious team, and if they box you in, it's hard to get out. So I think, like I said, like, maybe I was the one breaking the lines, but definitely not the only one. You know, like, Aveen Cleary and stuff, and Moyer coming out of the defense, like, they had unbelievable games as well. And I suppose it kind of fell into place on the day, I think.
Yeah, you can see Moira Shoxley got a hell of a lot of possessions that day, collecting ball off defenders or even kick out short. Who would you base your game on, Vicky? Is there anyone you'd look at and say, that's how I want to play?
I don't think so. I think there's certain elements of different players that you kind of look at and you admire and acknowledge. But then I suppose it's kind of like you said, like, what's your job on the day, you know, that kind of way. So we, like, our job was to get the ball to the people that were going to be scoring on the day. You know, I don't think I had a shot on goal on the day. But, you know, I don't care about that at all, to be honest. You know, it's give the ball to the right person in the right place. And, you know, like, Dougie getting a goal and Jetta, it was always there, and Evo Sullivan. So, like, I think the thing I noticed watching the match back for the 10th time in the last few weeks, that, like, everyone did their role to perfection, you know, that kind of way. Like, everyone has an individual role and everyone stood up and did their role on the day. So I think that was something that was nice to acknowledge.
I don't know if you got a chance to speak to Conor today. I know you're all doing these remotely, but Conor Myler was on a little earlier and we were talking about his role, I suppose, this year, and he's been tasked with a lot of man-marking jobs over the last couple of years. And while he does it, and he does it for the team, it isn't necessarily how he wants to play football. He likes to express himself and to play ball. How do you like to play football?
Yeah, I suppose I like to play football at a fast pace. Like to, you know, like, I suppose this controversy of is women's football touch, non-touch, contact, non-contact, all that kind of stuff. But I suppose it's the physicality of the game is kind of improving over the last few years. And, you know, obviously my role probably has changed a bit in previous years. I probably would have been closer to the goals, but I suppose maybe that the fact that my fitness has improved over the last few years, that I'm able to kind of contribute to the team in a different way. So, look, I'm happy to be on the pitch is my main thing. So I don't care where I play, I'm just happy to be on the pitch.
You mentioned club football a little earlier. Emma Duggan, same club as yourself. She's 18 years old. Like the way
19
that Emma,
now.
No, she's 19. Okay, there you
19
go.
19 there, yeah.
The way she's striking football at the minute and the scores that she scored that day, like there is absolutely no doubt in my mind that she meant that goal. And I know that she had previously tried something like that. Fergal Lynch was tweeting about it in a minor game a couple of years ago and it was disallowed. The skill levels in that Meath team over the last couple of years, how have you seen them develop, I suppose, in the last two or three years? Because we know there was the much-cited lows of 2015 where Cork Hammergy out the gate. And I know that there was a lot of changes to the panel over those years. And a few players maybe have come back in the last wee while, but a lot of young players have come through too. Have you seen a development in the skill levels?
Yeah, and I think not alone the skill level, but just even like the fitness levels and the strength as well. Like that, and even I think confidence comes into play with that as well. Like it's easy to kind of, not easy, but as in it's a lot easier to show the type of football you are if your team's playing with confidence. Mm. That kind of way. And I think that's definitely something that's improved in the last few years. But then it comes back to training as well, like as in the training we're getting like from Paul Garrigan and the lads, and like Eugene Evers in with strength and conditioning, like the training we're getting, like as in they don't leave anything undone. Do you know that kind of way? Everything is thought of, and it's not going to be, let's say, our fitness on the day that doesn't get us over the line. Do you know that kind of way? We want it to be, we don't want any excuses other than like to be play football. Do you know that kind of way? So I think, yes, the skill level has definitely increased. And, you know, that's down to girls putting in individual work as well, whether it's their kicking style or soloing or whatever it is. A lot of girls have done a lot of individual work. But then again, when we like that training, the standard has just increased hugely as well over the last few years.
I was lucky to get coached by Mick Bahan for a couple of weeks probably in DCU. But it always stuck with me, the style of coaching that he had. And my kick passing definitely even improved, just thinking back in the sessions I had with him. And he spoke, I think it was the week before the All-Ireland final. I'm not sure if you're reading the papers that weekend, but he spoke about bringing in a biomechanical scientist to work on the kicking techniques of the Dublin footballers at the time. Like the Dubs became the standard setters for the last couple of years. And before that, it was the great Cork team. And before that, it was the Mayo team that had won a couple in a row. Like you were going up against behemoths of the game in the semi-final and the final. It's an average age of about 24 in that Meath team. You seem to play with no fear. Like you mentioned the confidence there. Like in the back of your head, is there no, like we could go out and get a trim in here? Or were you just that steadfast in your belief of the group and the game plan that you had that you could go out and play with a bit of freedom?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I thought that too deeply about it, but I just think like if I went and sat down and looked at my games that I played for Meath, like I'd still say I have more losses than wins, you know, that kind of way. So I think like we've actually lost so many games and so many kind of close games in previous years that like the fear is not there. Like, you know, we've done it, like we've lost the All-Ireland finals at Croke Park. So like, what is the fear? Like, in that kind of way, is it's like, yeah, like in 2019, like the week after that All-Ireland loss probably was one of the worst weeks of my life. It was just horrendous, you know, you're really overthinking really everything and just, you know, you're kind of like your purpose before the All-Ireland is the All-Ireland, you know, you're so focused on your job and what you have to do. And no one goes into an All-Ireland final thinking they're going to lose. So I think like the week after that, whether it's a win or lose, the come down is tough. Do you know that kind of way? Even being away from the girls, we were talking about separation anxiety the last few weeks. You know, any excuse this week, we're trying to work out our training schedules. We can meet up in the evenings and stuff like that. But yeah, I think it's tough in the sense that like teams play, I suppose when you play fear, like I said, you're more reserved. And I think maybe we felt in the Cork game, a bit of fear did trickle in. So I suppose it was something that we were very conscious of in the final. And it's like at the end day, it is a game of football, do you know, kind of way, and there's like the fear wasn't there, I think, because we've lost a lot. So I think that kind of played into it as well.
I missed the semi-final live. We were in the midst of we were 6 points up my club team in a championship game in injury time, and we lost by a point. at the exact same time that
comeback.
Yeah, at the exact same time that you guys pulled it off. So I know what it's like to be on the receiving end of it. What's it like being on the winning end of a sensational comeback like that in injury time?
Yeah, it was kind of a weird one because, you know, people are asking us like what was going through your head in the last 5 minutes. But in comparison to previous years, like there actually wasn't a lot going through my head. Like, I don't think there was much thinking. I think if we'd taken the time to think, we wouldn't have been able to get the comeback. You're kind of, you're just literally thinking, next ball, like, let's get a score, next ball, let's get a score. Like, the only time I looked up at the clock was, I think, when there was literally like 20 seconds left. So I think.
And that's when you forced the turnover, right, for the final point.
Yeah, exactly. So it was kind of do or die at that stage. You know, we literally just had to press high and, you know, the ball came out short and then we got our opportunity and we took it. So I suppose you had that momentum going into extra time. So that kind of, I think, pushed us over the line. But yeah, in comparison to previous years, you know, when you're down by a few points, you're doing a lot of thinking, a lot of, oh God, it's slipping away now and that kind of stuff. I actually don't remember having those thoughts in that game.
You mentioned the two All-Ireland finals or the All-Ireland finals that you had lost in the last couple of years. December 2020, you finally get the job done in the intermediate final. You win a Division 2 title then earlier this year. So you had experience in Croke Park. But losing finals and getting the finals and getting over the line, those experiences must really bond you as a team. And I'm not surprised to hear you mention the separation anxiety there. We know it's a young squad in Meath. Like, how do you make sure that you foster that now over the next wee while? Like, have you even begun to think about that yet? How do you make sure that, you know, this isn't just a one and done?
Yeah, I don't think that's going to be an issue of keeping girls together. I think like the enjoyment that we get out of playing together and like being together is just second to none. Like our county football this year has been our club. Do you know, kind of way, like we haven't been with our clubs at all this year, really. So I don't think that's going to be an issue. And like, there's been a really good group of core group of younger girls have come up, and they've come up in a bunch of six or seven. So it's very easy for them to kind of integrate more into the team when there's a group of them. You know, it's not like in previous years when we might have only had one or two kind of younger girls coming up, and it's kind of maybe a bit daunting. So I think just kind of keeping that cycle, you know, the minors won the Leinster final this year, so there's definitely a good handful of them that will be brought up, I'd say, next year. So just keeping that cycle. You know, we had a panel this year of 37. That's not including people, I think, that couldn't train and stuff like that with long-term injuries. So I suppose keeping that panel, and it meant that we can play full games and we can, you know, really challenge each other is very important. So I think keeping that going and in the right direction is important.
One of the most exciting developments, I suppose, in the women's game over the last few while has been the realistic proposition of playing professional sport when it comes to the AFLW. There was definitely occasions when it was possible to play both, and it seemed to work really seamlessly with the ladies' football calendar and the AFLW calendar. Is that something you'd have in your mind for down the line, that you'd love to have a go at something like that?
Yeah, it's definitely not something I'd rule out. You know, the thought of playing like it's professional or semi-professional sport is something that, you know, would have appealed to me from a young age. So yeah, it's definitely not something I'd rule out. You know, I'm here in Ireland anyway for the year now. I'm starting a master's in DCU this week. So that's my focus now for the next while. So yeah, look, I suppose in the future, it's not something I'll rule out.
Good stuff. Well, we don't want to lose any more Meath footballers to Australia. So stick with it for a bit longer, Vicky. Congratulations on becoming the PwC GPA Women's Player of the Month for September. Congratulations on your All-Ireland medal. And thanks for chatting to us on OTB AM.
Thanks, man, Tommy.
OTB AM.
4 minutes past eight here on OTB AM. Peter G says, Ireland is not a Manchester, lads. Ha ha. Good man, Peter. Will Shane be doing the, what's the celebration? S-I-U-U-U-U. What is it?
I would butcher it if I tried to do it. It's Ronaldo's trademark. What he screams every time he scores. Yeah.
How do you say it?
See. Something like that. It's like see, but there's a little Portuguese lilt at the end of it.
Okay. All right. I'll never understand the Irish affinity with English Football Club. Nothing against it. I just don't understand it, says Darrow O'Toole. He must have missed the part about a bunch of Irish people being forced from their homes to go and live in England, which obviously was one of the reasons why we got forced to go there in the first place. Setting up communities there, building a network of support and surviving. And then the worst part about it is that they get abused by Irish people who call them plastic, the next generation. It's like, hang on a second, what? I think that was an interesting point that you brought up about the Irishness there. And it's the same in Liverpool. Liverpool elected a Home Rule MP, I think, before anybody else did. And So that bit of my history is a little bit woolly. Mine stopped at junior cert. And like, is there nothing that we can do to kind of say that we have an affinity with these things? That like all of our best footballers were exported to this league as a matter of course from the 50s on, and we're not allowed to have some kind of affinity with this? What's wrong with this? I mean,
I don't understand why you like American rock stars.
It's like, what?
Why can't people enjoy things? Why can't people?
You're not allowed.
This is the problem, Jaron, and I see it quite often. And comments come up, you know, people saying, "Why don't you support your local team? Why don't you follow a League of Ireland team instead of
going
over?"
Oh, John, wait, John Buckley, why doesn't Shane follow his local team instead of traipsing over to Manchester?
There we go. That's the exact comment that I get every single time I talk about United or anything else. It's hate from a certain quarter. Why does there have to be this divide? First of all, Monaghan United are out of existence. I don't have, essentially out of existence. There's no League of Ireland team at the moment. I don't have a local team as such. I play football for my local team, Monaghan Town, if that's good enough for John Buckley.
Why
can't we do both? Like the reason I support United is because my grandfather went over to Manchester to work in construction in the, whatever it was, the 50s, the 60s, brought back United memorabilia for my dad. He became a United fan, watched the Busby Babes, passed it along to me. That doesn't mean, like, why can people not support a team in England and also follow, like, Georgie Kelly, incredible goal for Bowes last night against Derry. Like, what's happening in the League of Ireland is really, really exciting. You can enjoy both.
No, you can't. You're not allowed. You're not
this
allowed.
This divide is, it's constant and ridiculous. You can follow.
Your brain's
a
not
of
big
Ireland
enough, team. Shane. None of us have big enough brains to be allowed to like football in one place and football in another place. And screw you if you think you're allowed to like rugby, because you're not. And if you've got time for GAA, you're not allowed. It's one or the other. That's it, Shane. You're not allowed.
This is a problem. People say, oh, like, why is this guy talking about GAA? He was talking about soccer.
Yeah,
last
who
week.
Are you?
Oh, no way. Oh, no way. We can follow multiple sports at a time.
No, you can't. And, you can't.
Like, next thing they'll diss my love of the random sports like snooker and Formula One, Jer. This is hard to take. People can't seem to enjoy things without getting absolutely.
The United fans are now getting suspicious. Hang on a second. He likes the League of Ireland too, and he likes GAA. So,
I mean, this is just, it's ridiculous. I knew those comments were going to come in as soon as I started talking about United and about Solskjaer and about heading over to Old Trafford. God forbid that I head over and enjoy myself and have a few pints with my mates and enjoy a game of football without it being on this island. I mean, oh, and Sheehan was in Paris enjoying a game during the week. And fair play to him. Why wouldn't he? Like, people are allowed to go to games and enjoy games.
No, he's a tourist. No, it's a disgrace. He's propping up the oil regime. That's what Sheehan's doing. He should have been down in Kerry agitating. Even on his holidays, he should have been whispering away to find out what was going on with the Kerry manager's job. But no, he's propping up the oil regime.
What I would say to people listening and watching, go to League of Ireland games if you have the chance, without a shadow of a doubt. And if you have a chance to support a team in England or Scotland or wherever it might be, go over and support them if you can and if you want to. Simple as that.
Follow your local team, Shane. That's it. That's what John Buckley says. Right. I obviously agree with you. 087-9180-180 is the WhatsApp number if you want to get in touch with us this morning. Or do feel free to leave some comments in the YouTube stream. We promise that we won't poo on all of them. We might on some of them, though. OTBAM is brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with our new and improved razors. I'm going to run you through the sports pages very quickly at 8:10 this morning. Caoimhín Kelleher, amongst plethora of young Ireland stars set to play midweek. It's kind of the day of the week. It's the tournament in particular that we have the most active interest in as Irish football fans. It's the Carabao Cup. They've got the power. Tip footballers retain management. Bevan Parsons is the key to Ireland making the World Cup, says Fiona Coughlan. Chelsea are much, much better than the Champions League winners, says Pat Nevin, who's been impressed by what he's seen so far. Manny Pacquiao retires from boxing to run for the presidency of the Philippines. I mean, it's about time he retired from boxing. He could really have done it about a decade ago, and his legacy wouldn't have been in any way damaged. The Irish Times front page, and nothing easy for McFarland's men as they seek to progress. This is kind of the start of the rugby season and the previews that are coming there, and Liverpool unleashing another wunderkind tonight. Cade Gordon, who is in contention for his debut this evening against Norwich, so he's going to hopefully come up against Andrew Omavamadeli. The Irish Sun back page, no free ride, Team Europe fly out. Lowry, I'll prove wildcard wasn't a friendly gesture. And People's Champ, Hero hopes his pain made boxing safer. That is Michael Watson, who obviously suffered a horrific brain injury in the ring. Irish Daily Mirror back page, Beyond Your Guard, Lingard, United have made a big statement to title rivals. He kind of celebrating reluctantly and then he celebrated properly. Lily's weight and COVID test results, so things going from bad to worse with Dundalk at the moment. Billy Perth, his squad suffering from COVID. City fans will snub Pep again. I mean, it's Wickham. I'm not going to be judging them tonight too much, but the Star back page, Riders on the Storm. Woozy hits out at moaning Koepka. Ian Woosnam has told Brooks Koepka to get a life and accused him of damaging Team USA's chances of winning back the Ryder Cup. It's the international beef we didn't know we needed. Ian Woosnam versus Brooks Koepka. Do you think Brooks Koepka knows who Ian Woosnam is?
Probably not. But it's just Brooks has kind of been running his mouth a little bit in advance of this. I love it. It makes it more interesting, in my opinion. So more power to Brooksy.
You can't like Formula One and golf, Shane. We all know that. Irish Daily Mail back page. Call of the Wild. Lowry eager to repay faith of his captain. And boost for Blues with Levy back in training. Fingers crossed that Dan Levy is back and fully fit and ready to go. He's only 27. So there could still be 7 or 8 brilliant years of... There could be 2 World Cups left in Dan Levy. And if he could get back to the form that we know he's capable of. The front page of the Telegraph, rather. Pakistan furious after England cancelled tour over security fears. Wenger, football's on dangerous ground, paying young too much. Players now get rewarded earlier. Before it was around 30 years of age. After that, around 25 and after 22. Now the speculation and the huge amounts of money is about players who might one day be players. That's where football goes on dangerous ground. Should we reward the people who produce quality? Yes. But when it's about players who might one day do that, then it's much, much more dangerous. I remember Stephen Bradley talking about being at Arsenal and checking his bank balance and the competitive desire essentially leaving his body at that point, because he was like, well, I've already made it now. And that was at Arsenal 15 years ago, maybe a bit longer. So that problem that Wenger's talking about there is real. Like the 16-year-olds who are playing in the Carabao Cup for the big teams, they're on massive contracts. They've already become millionaires at that point, and it will be very difficult for them to manage that for the rest of their lives. Fans can take us to celebrate your goal. How did you feel about Jesse Lingard not celebrating?
He had to celebrate. I mean, like, especially when it's a loan. Like, he was only on loan at West Ham United. We're still his parent club. And Ronaldo and Bruno Fernandes were absolutely right to push him to celebrate. I don't like this whole not celebrating against your old club. Like, I get it in some instances if you've served a long, long time for the previous club, but no. Jesse, I think the smirk on his face told us that he knew he had to celebrate in the end.
Should Messi celebrate against Barca if he scores?
That's probably a little bit more awkward. But I feel like, absolutely, why not? Go for it. I mean, if it was me in that position, absolutely, just go for it.
Top off.
Give it loads. Give it even twice the celebration you would have done. Yeah, absolutely.
Don't ruin the Raducanu effect. This is Andy Murray, who says that they need new tennis courts across the UK. Ronaldo right over penalty and Pakistan fury at tour snub. I didn't get to the James Corrigan piece in the Golf. What Americans can learn from Europe's bad blood. The beef between Harrington and Sergio, which was really intense. We have zero in common bar the fact that we both play golf. He is the antithesis of me and I am the antithesis of him. That is exactly what Paul Carrington said about Sergio Garcia to The Guardian. When was this? In 2007? About that? There are guys that get a little bit fortunate. They get in contention in a major and manage to get things going their way, says Garcia, about how lucky Harrington had been to win a couple of majors against him. I'm playing against a lot of guys out there, more than the field, said Garcia, when the beef was at its most real. But the beef, it all went okay. Apparently, Harrington kind of nearly stoked it in 2017 on off the ball. I gave him every out I possibly could have at the 2000 Open. I was as polite as could be and was as generous as I could be, but he was a very sore loser, and he continued to be a very sore loser. This is Harrington after they've made peace. It was like, wow. And then apparently they ended up bumping into each other at Rory McIlroy's wedding, And Harrington apologised to say, actually, what I was really trying to say was that, like, even though you were a very sore loser, you'd served your time and you deserved to win the Masters, and congratulations. And Sergio was like, yeah, I suppose I was also young when I was, you know, trying to stand in your line and distract you on the final day of a major.
I think this is why Europe, like, this is why Europe are going to tear up Whistling Straits, because they have a captain in Patrick Harrington who puts aside petty rivalries and bitterness to pick the best players, and Sergio Garcia deserves to be picked in that team. And like you saw the pre-tournament press conferences in the last couple of days, and Harrington looks like a man completely born for his position, smiling away, ready for it. And Stricker looked a bit more reserved, I want to say, not quite sure about the whole Brooks Bryson thing either. I just think this is Europe's to lose, which seems like a strange thing to say when they're heading off to Whistling Straits. But Harrington is a man with steely determination in his eyes.
Back page of the Herald is bullseye on Tyrone Heads. They're already talking themselves into their seed mentality that will no doubt see them to three of the next five All-Irelands if history is going to repeat itself. Speaking of which, Tyrone star Conor Myler has been named the PwC GAA GPA Player of the Month for September. Yesterday, he caught up with Tommy Rooney. The full chat's available on the OTB GAA podcast feed. It's a good 40 minutes. We're going to jump in here as we get stuck into the various man-marking jobs that Myler pulled off this summer. Did he enjoy it?
Don't know if I particularly enjoy it. At the end of the day, everybody wants to play football and go out and probably express themselves and play pretty freely, but it's something that's it's going to benefit the team, like, and it's probably that selfless act of doing the dirty work and keeping opposition key player.
You must get a wee bit of sick enjoyment out of it, though.
I was laughing at stages in the All-Ireland final. I think it was more just me trying to enjoy the whole thing. But no, it is pretty selfless because, you know, you don't get the opportunities in usually on the front foot. And I think that was a big change I made in the last 2 years was trying to put players in the back foot and to really get to show my own game. And it's difficult to do that when you're being so tight and marking so tightly. And in previous games over the years, you can get caught out if you lose the ball and you've already gambled and gone. So I found the balance this year pretty well in marking close and tight, and then also being able to offer a wee bit more going forward. And I had a lot of kick passes in the semi-final and the final, and that's just backing myself a wee bit more too and sort of saying, you know, have a go. And even, you know, I felt comfortable coming up one-to-one and sidestepping men and going and that, and I just felt comfortable on the ball this year too. And I suppose that just comes with confidence. And I say I was glad that it was nice to actually get a bit of recognition too at times, because over the years you're doing that and nobody really picked up on it. And It was never in the search of individual accolades or anything, because the stuff you're doing, it is selfless. And even, you know, things that people don't see, it's maybe tracking 100 yards just to try and put a block onto somebody or to put in a tackle somewhere. And those are probably the things that, when you add it up, are hugely important in a team sport and a team game to make the difference than the fancy scores. So I'll let McCurry and McShane and boys had the fancy scores and I just set it up for them.
Well, the Dazzler was certainly kicking the fancy scores all this year. But just a wee bit more on the man-marking role, Conor, because I find it interesting, because when you think of it in I suppose, traditional sense, when you think of a man-marker, you're thinking of a Paddy Hamsey, say, taking out a corner forward, or Ronan McNamee going up against David Clifford, or even, I remember Lee Keegan, there were some brilliant pieces done on him back in 2016-17, where he man-marked Sean Kavanagh, Shane Walsh. And the stats were Keegan scored 1-2 and he kept them scoreless from play. But they were, to me, they strike me as quite different footballers to the lads that you were taking down. Paddy Clifford's a link player who is the glue to that Kerry attack. He's getting the ball all over the pitch. Ryan McHugh is very much the same. He's the lifeblood of that Donegal attack. How are you meant to stop a fella like that? Because it strikes me that it would be much easier that, you know, you're in the corner, you can look him up, you know he's going to dummy on his left, or Clifford's little hop dummy on his right, whatever about all the video analysis, how good that does you. But how do you prepare to take on a player who's looking to get on the ball all over the field like Paddy Clifford or Paddy Durkin?
It's tough. It is tough. And you're up against some of the best in Ireland, really. And you sort of have to accept sometimes that these boys are going to score or they're going to get possessions. These guys are getting 30 plus possessions in a game. And, you know, I can only limit them so much. So it's a case of accepting that in one sense, and to, you know, probably do my detail. I'd be quite diligent and in the work I do in preparation. So, you know, you're watching between 50 and 100 clips of these guys. So you're watching games anyway. And
what are you looking for there?
Just tendencies, you know, things that they maybe tend to do. Dummies, if they're late runs, things like that, that maybe if I am aware of it before the game, then you're more conscious of it and you're reacting to it rather than thinking, because during the match, you don't have time to think. You're just reacting, and the more time you spend doing that early in the week, I found, and then in training, trying to mark maybe similar style players helps, because one week you're playing wing forward on Paddy Durkin, then the following, you know, the week before you're sort of centre back, and then in other games you're standing full back at times. So that's all in the preparation. And I think even just coming into the game then, it's more a case of accepting things and surrendering, in the sense of, I don't know what's going to happen here, and I've done the work, and relax and just sort of say, let's see what happens, and whoever comes out on top, may the better man win as such. But I like that battle. Like, I do,
yeah.
I do enjoy a battle as such, and knowing that, right, let's go to war here and see who comes out on top. And I can accept that sometimes these boys are going to score and sometimes they're going to get chances. And
yeah,
if I'm just keep at it and chip away, then hopefully break them down. Like,
that was some battle with Clifford, and he kept going till extra time. You stuck with him, but like, as Kerry were, some of the players maybe were falling away a wee bit, he kept going. So that battle was going on for the full game. And I didn't actually notice it at the time, but after the game, I was going back just looking for an image from the game. We were doing a piece in the show the next day, and I put in Paddy Clifford, and everywhere Clifford went, you were there. I don't know if you searched the photos in Sportswild, but there's about 20 photos of you just pawing him or pulling him or winning the ball before him or just going ahead of him. And then afterwards, Paddy Andrews was speaking about it. And I think it was Paddy, or could have been one of the lads. I confuse them all the time, but Clifford misses that shot on goal, the hand pass towards the end of extra time. And you can only see it in the reverse camera shot, but you're on the sideline and you just go, yes. I don't know if you're shouting in his face or you're shouting to yourself, but it was a massive moment.
Yeah, like that for me is just, that's as good as a score for me. That's like job done. Like, you know, that's another one, another small battle one as a sense, put him under enough pressure that the fist went wide. So, as I say, that's where I get my joy out of. Like, it's
the oxygen,
it's things like that. It's making tackles, turnovers, possessions. That's what I'm basing my game on. So, it's small wins like that, not to his face, because after the game was over and I was very complimentary of him and what a season he's had, and he'll be back better. Without a doubt, he's one of the best there is. And the same, even the final, you're nearly going over and thanking Paddy Durkin as such for a battle, because that's what you want. I don't think when you're at the elite end, you don't want easy games. There's something nice about a battle and to come out on top of it. So you're nearly thanking these boys for a tough game and nearly like, I'll see you again in the future sort of thing, because like, inevitably, like, future games, like, them boys could toast me, like, and I just have to accept that. So, yeah, small wins.
I was speaking to Kieran McGeary in the tunnel under Croke Park after the game, after the All-Ireland final, and we had a word about McShane, and he said, the big man delivers on the big days. So, Colin McShane is only on the pitch, I'd say, a minute, and Paddy Hansey's coming down the line and he gives you that hand pass. Now, I don't know how many times you've watched this go back, but I've watched it back a few times. The second you receive the ball, I think it's in your left hand, McShane does his backdoor cut and he's pointing the other way. Now, we know the winners write the scripts. We've been looking at Conor Callaghan doing this backdoor cut and Kilkenny giving him the hand pass for the last 7 or 8 years. Do you know McShane is making that cut before you receive that ball? Are you thinking, he's on, let's go direct, this is my chance to show my football and take a chance here? Because it was a brilliant ball, but you know yourself, it's an All-Ireland final. It's the second half. Scores are hard to come by. You are taking a risk there with that pass.
Yeah, and that's kind of like when you're in that sort of flow or the zone as such, you're not thinking. And I wasn't thinking there. Like, I wasn't thinking about the crowd or the score. I mean, you know, that was something. Gal's not short of confidence. Like, he's constantly, I'll just tell you, put the ball in on top of me. And I just seen the cut. Literally just got it, seen the cut. and just thought, let's put it in on the big man and see what he can do. And thankfully, the flight of the ball, it landed close enough to the keeper and it went in. But that game was just backing myself, you know, having the courage to just go for it. And, you know, I had a lot of kick passes in that game and a number of assists where I was just like, just go for it. And
Did you give Darragh Canavan a wee bit of stick for not burying that goal as well?
Who, sorry?
Did you give Darragh Canavan a bit of stick for not burying that goal?
He's too likeable to give him sticks. But again, that's just, as I say, just go for it and I can accept whatever really happens after the pass. It was so intense and tight that I was overthinking everything and overanalyzing things. And now, just knowing that, you know, you remind yourself sometimes it is just a game and it's the same game you've been playing since you were 14. 15 aside, whoever scores more wins, and that's it. Like, and sometimes we overanalyze and overhype it, and me, I'd have been the worst for it, the worst overthinker. And now to just sort of be like, let's see what happens. It's very refreshing, and it's definitely helped me that I can sort of look in the mirror after a game and sort of say, you know, you've done all you can do, and that's it. That's life. Life goes on. Yeah, I think just reminding myself of those things this year has been powerful.
You've spoken about the man in the glass, a poem that you've referenced a few times, and I know you were speaking afterwards as well about authenticity and vulnerability and using them and finding them. I want to come back to that in a second, but you mentioned a kind of flow state there as the ball came to you. Like, I'm fascinated with that when it comes to sports people, and you see it when a fella's knocking a putt or maybe someone's taking a key kick in rugby or something. Were you in a flow state for that whole All-Ireland final, or is it just moments? Like, I know it's hard to quantify, but like, you did feel it that time, did you?
Yeah, like, I don't know. In team sport, it is really interesting topic. And like, I enjoy reading and delving into things like that, the sports psychology side of things. And I read a really good book this year called In the Zone. And it references a lot of things like that and trying to find the zone, and people find it in different ways. You know, Arden Senna, the F1 driver, talked about nearly feeling like an out-of-body experience where he was watching himself drive the car, things like that. I think the big difference in team sport and a match like in Gaelic football, you can't be in the zone the whole time because it's stop, start, play, and then you get your water breaks, your half time and stuff. But there's definitely moments where you just react and you don't have time to think, especially in a game like that. People look like they've got time on the ball, but you don't have time to think. So in that moment, it was literally just first thought. It was a very quick glimpse that Cal made the cut, and I thought, just go for it. So I say it's something Cal be backing himself all year under a high ball. If it was somebody different, he might have played a different style of ball, but thankfully it paid off too.
When it comes to authenticity and vulnerability, they aren't two traits that you'd immediately associate with, on a surface level anyway, top level sports people. Like, how did that click that you needed to tap into that? Like, because listening to you, and I know you're in a really good place with your football now, but like, you've had challenges over the years where you didn't make minor squads, or perhaps you played a bit of reserve football when you were younger, or you maybe just didn't feel like you were possibly getting the best that you could have got out of yourself. When did it click for you that you needed that?
Authenticity, vulnerability stuff is probably something I've only learned this year. There's a guy, give him a shout out now on Instagram, he's Drew Brighton, calls himself the fear coach, and I would have looked at his work. It's so different than what everybody else is talking about. And it's literally just that idea of acceptance, vulnerability, authenticity, that deep authenticity of who are you really as a person. And delving into that stuff is deep, and it's actually tough to be completely honest with yourself at times. But you sort of find that people respect you more when you are yourself. You can't keep everyone happy, and at the end of the day, not everyone's going to like you either. So when you're comfortable in your own skin, it's refreshing because, you know, I like my own company as it is. So just knowing that I can spend time by myself and be happy and content, it's great. And But the whole idea of the progress from there to now, I know I spoke about it somewhere else, just that like my dad would have managed some of the underage teams from the club, and the team a year above, he would have put me in the B team because I wasn't good enough for the A team, and you know, they were off playing all the top teams, winning championships, and I was playing in the lower divisions just to get game time. And I used to hate it, like, because my friends were all playing on the other team and we're both heading off to football, and I'm jumping on one bus, he's jumping on another, my dad. And then obviously come through to sort of senior level, and dad was managing the senior team, and you know, I got a lot of flack for, you're only playing your dad as a manager sort of stuff. And even around the time, you know, the year before, I came on as a sub in the reserve championship. I was doing a lot of cross country and running and stuff, and probably physically wasn't developed enough, and you had a lot to work on in terms of my physique and everything as well to go with Gaelic football. So when I decided I'm definitely going down that route, I just put everything into it, and in the space of 2 years, from 18 to 20, you know, say not making that minor team, I was gutted and had a chip on my shoulder. I wanted to sort of prove even to people in my club that, you know, within for teams I wasn't making and the rest, and then that minor team that I can kick on. And at 20, I was playing in the All-Ireland semi-final against Kerry, the youngest player in the pitch that day, and played five championship games that year for Tyrone. Was drafted straight in for the championship. So, like, it was a bit surreal, but that sort of idea of a chip on your shoulder and this idea of I could outwork everybody by, you know, running to the gym, crawling under the fence and doing a session, then running home and like a 1 mile time trial nearly, before and after. I was just so driven, but I couldn't sustain it because at inter-county level, you try to do the extra training outside of training, it just breaks you down, and you're playing college football and club football all the time. And I just kept getting injured, 2016, right? And that was really tough, like. And then a bit of a turnaround at 17, won the Sigerson and was captain. We won the club championship and Tyrone won Ulster. And from then, we've been a bit of a regular within the team. But, say, just taking it to that next level this year was really doing that deep authenticity work and the work with Drew. So,
well, you mentioned the older boys a little earlier, and we won't name them again because you might get a bit of stick for it, but I know you're studying leadership, and just a couple of questions on that before we finish up, but when did you feel like you could be yourself in that Tyrone dressing room? Like, that hardly happened when you first broke in.
When I first broke in 2015, my mindset was very much, I'm here to take jerseys. Like, I'm here to start, I'm here to play, I don't really care about anybody. And then you probably fall into second-year syndrome of maybe wanting to be liked and appreciated by boys, and you know, that maybe filtered into 17 and 18, where you just wanted to be part of a team. And I think in every team, everybody just wants to feel that safety of being part of something. So probably chasing that at times and losing track of myself. And that's where the man in the glass comes into things then too. So the last couple of years have probably just, you know, especially this year. And when I say this, it's not like a total transformation of a person. Like, I've always been myself, but just on a deeper level now, I just have a better understanding, and I'm content going and doing my own thing at times. If other fellas want to go and do something else, you know, I don't feel the need to always join in. Like, so whatever I want to do, I do. And I know my body better now, which is a big thing physiologically, how much load I can tolerate. And in terms of injury prevention work that has helped me this year, and different mobility work and working with different coaches and for different things, and breathing and how my body moves more efficiently, all the rest, adding all those wee bits to my game this year has definitely taken it to another level. But as I say, I still feel like I was playing well over the years, but you maybe got a wee bit more recognition now. People started to maybe see things differently, and obviously being more offensive and being a bit braver. Small tweaks has made a big difference.
Connor, when Netflix dropped The Last Dance last year, we all got very excited. There wasn't a huge pile for any of us to be doing at the time, but anyone interested in sport got very excited about it, and we all got stuck into it. Kieran Donaghy did a podcast with us here on Off the Ball with Owen Sheehan and Jarlett Regan, so we were chatting about it every week. But I hadn't actually copped the blog post you'd written about it on your LinkedIn. But there's a line in it that I thought was really interesting. Within the GAA, I would find it harmful to encourage players to be like Mike. Can you talk to us a wee bit about that? Because I think you're right in the sense that anyone who comes off something like that, you're like, look at what Jordan did. Look at how he is. Why would you encourage players to not be like Mike?
Well, he was a tyrant, wasn't he? Like he was just, the thing is too, he was so intense on the court that he got so much wrong off it. And I think when you try to emulate other people like that, you know, there is no comparison really with what we do in the GAA to the professional basketballer like him. Lifestyle, everything else, like you would have to put your whole life on hold and really, you know, be an unpleasant person, as well put it, in a nice way, to everyone else and everyone else around you. And I just don't think that's sustainable in the GAA in a team environment of a squad of 30. You know, to be the alpha male, the macho, the I am the best, the greatest, just give me the ball all the time. I just don't think it works in the GAA, and my concern was that people would look up to after the documentary were all in the height. And it was great to see the mindset of an elite athlete. But you also see the dark traits as well, with the narcissistic traits and stuff that, you know, him and Tiger Woods are the same in that sense. You know, where they had to really, they're authentic in a sense that they're being themselves, they don't care what anyone else thinks, which you can take something from that. But at the same time, I would value being a good person as much as being a good footballer as well. And to have longevity in the GAA, I think you need to be a good person, because GAA is more than just the game, it's the community, it's the families, it's what it does for your club, your surrounding towns, villages. There's more to it, and I think being a good person within the GAA community is as important as playing as well. So that's why I don't think that mindset and that attitude that Jordan had would be sustainable in that environment.
When you're talking about the club and the community, Joe McMahon was one of the first people to embrace you on the pitch in Croke Park afterwards. I presume yourself and your dad have had a couple of nice moments, and the family have had a couple of nice moments since as well.
Yeah, well, the family is the first people I went looking for, because at the end of the day, they're there for you all year and every year and through every moment, good and bad, when you're getting sick, when you're everything else, they're there for you and they love you and they care for you. So I think that's the most important thing. You know, after a big win or a final, everybody wants to be your friend, but you know, the family were there for you all year. So it was important to go to them, and then see Joey is just class, because like Joey was my idol growing up as a cub, and I have a photo with Joey and Sam in the house, you know, where he's towering over me, must have been younger than 10, like, and just in awe of him and what he achieved. So have a role model like that within our club, and Justy too, you know, Justy's a legend, and I do look up to those boys still, because what they achieved was so significant for our club. That's, you know, now I hope that what myself and Ronan have done, it will inspire some of the younger boys within the club to just be like, sure, there's Connor and Ronan. Like, we see them training. We see them down the club there, down the cafe. And I can do that as well. And that's the thing with winning all Ireland too. You've hopefully inspired the next generation. Even Joe's just a good person. And so is Justy. They're good, kind people, and they would have been texting me before games and after games over the years, even when they're not involved. So even for me to get a chance to play them at senior level within the club was a dream, and then Tyrone senior play with the boys for a couple of years. It's surreal to look back at, you know, the wee photo of me and Joe and Sam, like, to think of what we've come through together.
That's class. Last one. I'd be very excited looking at next year's GAA Gaelic football season, especially when you're thinking Darragh Canavan's only a kid. We haven't seen the best of him yet. Conor McKenna's home. He's only really given you moments this year. And I know he's probably, he says himself, he hasn't got the best out of him, which is a scary proposition. And we know the big man, McShane, has only given you fits and bursts so far this year, and he's not fully back to fitness. You're someone who strikes me is obsessed with improving as a footballer all the time. You spoke earlier on about wanting to show your football skills as well as stopping players. What's next for Conor Moyler?
Good question.
You've soaked it in now, so you got to move on to the next one.
Bit of downtime, I think, still needed. But, geez, good question. What's next? I still will be critical of myself, regardless. There are still moments, you know, I'd like to be more involved still, but you know, maybe people are more aware now as well, so my game might have to change. But again, it's that selfish thing of whatever Fargo and Brian ask you to do, you're willing to do it. I do think as a collective, we have a lot more in us, and we've only played in spells this year, especially offensively, defensively. We've been very sound, throwing in Michael McKiernan and Polly, and Michael probably hasn't got as much credit as he deserves because he's been sensational this year too. But offensively, I think we have a lot more in us when you talk about the players you've listed there. And I say, boys, not making the 26 even, they could have just been awesome in training. But they're going to want to kick on now as well. There's going to be younger fellas in the 20s and minors who are going to want to come through as well. So I think Tyrone's in a good place, definitely. People talk about us being hunted now. I very much see us as the hunter still, and we are chasing the All-Irelands of the Kerrys and the Dublins, and I think that we do have more in us, and hopefully we get to show that, because it would be easy to get carried away now. And we're very lucky to have the likes of Brian, Pete Donnelly, who will without a doubt not let us get too far ahead of ourselves. So I do think it's important to soak it all in and to enjoy it, because these opportunities might come around again. We just don't know with football, and that's the crazy thing with us, and that's what makes it even more special winning, was you achieve something that you trained for so long for, and you failed and you failed and you failed, and you finally come back again and do it. So yeah, I think we'll soak it all in before we start thinking about next year, but it's going to be hard to top it.
Conor Moyler, congrats on winning the PwC GAA GPA Player of the Month for September, and congratulations on winning your first All-Ireland medal.
Thank you very much, Tommy.
Yeah, really interesting stuff there from Conor Moyler in conversation with our own Tommy Rooney. We'd love to hear from you this morning. 0879 180 180 is the WhatsApp number, or of course, you can leave a comment in the YouTube stream. And OTBAM is brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette, putting your best face forward with their new and improved razors. At 8:44 a.m. this morning, we're joined by John Duggan in the studio. John, good morning to you. How are you?
Good, Jaron. Chain yourselves.
What's going on?
Well, we had a brilliant game at Dennymount Park last night. A 3-3 draw between Bohemians and Derry in the League of Ireland Premier Division. It means Bohemians stay fifth, but they've got a couple of games in hand on the Candy Stripes. Georgie Kelly, what a pearler of a goal. They both swapped goals in injury time, both sides. We had Liam Burt and Jamie McGonigal scoring great goals earlier in the game, but Georgie Kelly took it on the chest, volleyed it in the top corner. I suppose one of the more sobering aspects of the whole evening was racist abuse directed anonymously on social media towards Junior, the Derry player, and they have come out and condemned that, Derry City. So sobering to see that again. We have the women's team, the Republic of Ireland, needs to be judged on results just like the men's team. 7 defeats in a row. They're hoping to turn that around against Australia at Tallaght Stadium tonight. The Matildas visiting Ireland, and Sam Kerr making her 100th appearance. 7 o'clock start. And the Irish skipper, Katie McCabe, is delighted to see fans back.
One, we're really looking forward to having them back. It's been so long, and the atmosphere they create every time they come is one that we love. That 12th player for us, you know, if obviously we're chasing a win or we need to get a goal, you hear them and they're right behind us every single time. That game against Ukraine at home always stands out for me, how electric it was that night.
Dundalk are without a host of players for their game in the FAI Cup, the quarterfinal replay against Finn Harps tonight. 4 players contracting COVID injuries as well. couldn't get any worse really for Dundalk at the moment. That's got a 7:45 start, and Finn Harps will have to think they've got a big chance. Also, League Cup action in England. We would hope to see Andrew Omobamidele, Adam Ida, Queevin Kelleher when Norwich play Liverpool. Daryl Horgan likely to be involved for Wickham against Man City. They're the pick of the ties. Europe have arrived in Wisconsin ahead of the Ryder Cup on Friday. Shane Lowry, Rory McIlroy, Patrick Harrington, the skipper, all there. Whistling Straits is the course. Steve Stricker hadn't seen Brooks Koepka yet when he gave his press conference yesterday, which was interesting, I felt.
Brooks was having a snooze, was he?
Maybe he was having a pint with Bryson. Patrick Harrington gave a very interesting answer when he was asked about why Europe have done so well in this. I was looking through the stats here. They've won 9 of the last 12 Ryder Cups, and he says it all started with Seve Ballesteros.
It started with Seve in the 80s. He pushed for this to become a continent of Europe rather than a Great Britain and Ireland, and it was a way for Seve to legitimise the European Tour. It was a way to give the European Tour a standing. The great players in Europe at the time didn't get access to play in all the best events in the world. Seve was always fighting against that, the tide in that, and playing and winning in the Ryder Cup was a way to say that Europe deserved a seat at the table. And, you know, you look at the great players we had in the 80s, and it came a lot came from Seve and those players to drive Europe into a much stronger position in world golf. And, you know, without a doubt, we rely on Seve for that. We have a, you know, we're here to play for, very much play for the European Tour. When I'm playing in Europe at the moment, you know, the last couple of weeks, South African players, Australian players and Asian players who play in our tour come up to me and, you know, wish me luck or are rooting for us because they know it's a big part of our tour, how we do in the Ryder Cup. So, yes, the technicality of qualifying is being born in the continent of Europe, but the reality is we are playing for the European Tour.
Thought that was an interesting comment from Patrick Harrington. It's funny, our emotions, and I remember I was devastated when Bernard Langer missed that putt in 1991 at Kiwa Island. We're very European for 3 days, and then a week later we're going, what? What's being a European? So that was my kind of thought about it.
I mean, it's what were those funds called that Albert Reynolds came back and was like, oh, I've got 5 billion, lads. There you go.
But he didn't get enough. Well, that was the whole argument. He didn't get enough structural funds.
Structural funds, that was it. Structural
from
funds.
From the EU.
That's what we needed, structures.
You know, I'm a big European. I really believe in ever closer union, I think was the coal and steel community back in the 50s. Just some breaking away from that, other news in the Independent reporting today that a former Irish rugby international is before a Dublin District Court today to face multiple fraud-related charges. The DPP has decided to press charges against a Dublin-based suspect who is aged in his 50s, reported by the Irish Independent today.
All right. One of the other things we wanted to talk about was a piece of the weekend from Tony Cascarino, who says that Chris Hughton should be the Ireland manager, essentially now, right? Not like at the end of this campaign, but in time for the Euros, and that what we need is a manager who's going to get more out of our mediocre playing stock than Stephen Kenny is going to get. Where do you stand on this, John?
Well, I interviewed Chris Hughton for OTB Saturday about a month or two ago, and he was very wedded to club management. Obviously, that's no longer live for him. He's a very proud Irishman, Chris Hughton. He was the first black player to play for Ireland, which he was proud of, and made over 50 appearances for his country. His mother's from Limerick. If I was to say, and he's a Spurs legend, I think he's an absolute gentleman, would I have got the sense from the interview that he intricately knows the Republic of Ireland scene? No, I wouldn't have had that sense. Do I have the sense that if the job was available in the future, he'd be interested? Absolutely, yes. I think he would be. When you think about Chris Hughton and Ireland, not as a player, but he was the coach under Brian Kerr between 03 and 05. And I would have to argue that we underachieved in that campaign. Against Israel, we blew it twice. We had a brilliant crop of players. I actually think Trapattoni's first campaign for the World Cup, we did really play well in that first campaign. But you'd Robbie, you'd Damien Duff, you'd Stephen, and you'd Shea Given, you'd all these players, Richard Dunn at the peak of their ages. I didn't really feel we should have qualified for that World Cup against France and Switzerland because we blew it against Israel. We only lost one game, but we blew it against Israel. That's just my personal view. I think that's separate to whether Brian Kerr should have been kept on or not. I think he did get a bit of a harsh ride from the three wise men at the time. Why is Chris Hughton not the Brighton manager? Because I think Tony Bloom at Brighton would have seen that Graham Potter espouses a more progressive style of management. And it's very easy for Tony Cascarino to make the argument, oh, we've got a very average group of players, but we've always punched above our weight. But for me, the way I see it is, the negatives of watching bad football over the last 10 years outweigh the positives of 2 to 3 great days. And when I looked at, I was all for Charlton, because Jack Charlton in 1986 went to the Mexico World Cup, saw that we could play a little bit of a different type of game, getting balls into the channels, long balls, but also we had very, very technically good players as well. And we played a style of play that was very difficult. Teams didn't get their head around it for about 6 or 7 years. And if you're getting the results at such a level, then you can really buy into it. And also it was our first romance. But in the last 10 years, I haven't seen enough positives to outweigh the negatives of what I've seen. And I'm willing, I'm really willing to just, for say, if I knew that in 10 years' time, we would have teams at under 21, under 19, senior level, all playing really attractive technical football, qualifying for tournaments, and then making an impact in tournaments, I'd be all for it. I would take all the sacrifices now. Because for me, qualifying for a tournament doesn't mean anything if you're going to get whipped by playing bad football.
We're stuck in a cycle. And we can either repeat the cycle and not learn from it, or we can try and break from this cycle to do something different. There are options.
Yeah. And Chris Hughton is, and I read The Athletic last weekend. Now, once again, they didn't get Chris Hughton's view on it, but it was quite a damning portrait. Now, Nottingham Forest hasn't been a particularly stable place to be a manager since probably Frank Clark left. But a lot of negativity about the style of play and the defensive style of play. And if this is all about pragmatism, I do agree. Damien Delaney made a good point that we do need to mix it up. And we do need to sometimes just do what we can to beat Luxembourg and Azerbaijan. Lack of a goal scorer is a real issue with that. But I don't see a regressive approach and a pragmatic approach and rolling up the sleeves and just getting the job done as ultimately, in the macro sense, progressing Irish football, as Stephen Kenny's trying to do, with the bad blackjack hand he's been dealt in terms of the players and the talent at his disposal.
Shane, what do you think? Oh, your sound's gone. You're on mute. The remote working only works if you unmute yourself.
Shane?
He's having a bit of a problem.
That's
having
okay.
A bit of a problem with the sound. We might dial him back there.
Yeah, no issue.
Back to work today, everybody. They didn't get the memo on Monaghan. I know everybody's been working for the last 18 months,
by
the way.
Was that not an album, Back to Work, by somebody?
Was that your 80s music knowledge is way better than mine.
Was it AC/DC or something like that?
Oh, right.
Or
Blank Stairs All Around.
The Beastie Boys. I'm just talking to myself here. But yeah, Chris Hughton, lovely man. And I think... it's just an easy argument to make. And really, I suppose the issue that Stephen Kenny has, I can't say with certainty if we're going to beat Luxembourg and Azerbaijan
no,
and get 6 points.
That's the thing.
I suppose that is the biggest issue. That we're doing really well in the matches we're not expected to, but we can't beat the tomato cans because we can't score goals.
And those results need to change. And that's the thing. And Kenny ultimately will be judged on results. I think that... we've been banging this drum for a while, that the confluence of events around COVID and taking over and the injuries and the players who weren't allowed to play for him means that he hasn't really had an opportunity yet to get his full team out very regularly. Since the summer, things have improved. They had a training camp. It's fair to say I think the quality of performances have improved, and they need to improve fast over the rest of this campaign so that he has a bit of wind behind him into the next campaign. Because if there's a blip at the start of the next campaign, then he needs to have some confidence in the bank, and at the moment, some credit in the bank, and he doesn't have any of that, and that's the issue. So,
the Nations League is hard to get your appetite up for next summer. So, in a way, you are waiting until March 2023, and that you're completely into no excuse territory. And I said to Kenny Cunningham last week, and Kenny was of the view, I think, that you can change things pretty quickly, and players can get behind something new quite quickly. But there is, as Jonathan Hill said, a strategic plan for the World Cup in America in 2026.
So,
So therefore, surely you'd have the same manager to progress you to that end goal of being all about the diaspora in New York and Chicago and all these places.
John, good stuff. Thanks very much for that. John Duggan with us there. You can see his preview of the Ryder Cup a little bit later on in the week on the OTV Sports website. And of course, you can hear him every Saturday afternoon on Off the Ball on News Talk from 1 o'clock to 5. Now, Dermot Corrigan is with us at 8:55 this morning. Dermot, good morning to you. How are you?
Hey, Jer, how's it going?
Yeah, well, good. We wanted to talk to you about the situation at Barcelona at the moment, because we're watching the collapse of an empire, and you've got a front row seat for it. So what is the actual sense in Spain about how low this is going to get before they start to kind of make some sort of a comeback?
Yeah, people around Barcelona, people around Barcelona are very worried and very scared at the minute about what's coming down the line, or what the situation is at the minute. Like, everybody kind of knew that Barca were in trouble. You know, the president had to resign last year. Laporta came in with a lot of optimism. But they've kind of hit the wall. Since Messi left in the summer, the team, there's just nobody in the team anymore who can play to the level that Barcelona fans want. And at the minute, there's a lot of people pointing fingers at each other. Koeman is saying, well, it's not my fault, I don't have the players anymore. Some of the players aren't happy with the tactics that the team are playing under Koeman. Laporta and Koeman are having this kind of strange public exchange of views over the direction the team should take. A lot of the fans, the kind of influential socios around the club are really upset at the direction things are going. And everything is just looking very, very doom and gloom. And last night against Granada, it's kind of embarrassing for Barca. You know, they conceded early in the game and they weren't able to get back into it at all. They ended up, you know, knocking lots of long balls into the box. They brought Piqué on to play as a centre forward for the last 15 minutes and ended up getting an equaliser with a header in injury time. But that's not how Barca are supposed to go about things. That's not how Barca fans see themselves at all. And it's, afterwards, there was a lot of recriminations. Koeman was defending himself in the press conference. And the mood is just not good.
It's like they made some Faustian pact with the devil, where it was like, we will see the greatest football that has ever existed for a short period of time. Then after that, we'll pay. But now the reckoning is coming, and it turns out that you've got to pay a very severe price. And I don't know, I guess it'll always be worth it, and that they saw some of the greatest football that we've ever seen. But I don't think anybody thought it was going to get as bad as it is now. And the trouble is that this isn't really the bottom, is it? There's a strong possibility that this team won't finish in the top four.
Yeah, like, in a way, they wasted what they had. They had such a great team. And, you know, for Xavi and Iniesta and Messi and everybody to come along at the same time is great fortune. You know, you can't expect that to happen all the time. But they had everything set up. They had the best production of young players in the world. They had a team that everybody wanted to join. All the other top players around the world wanted to join. They had loads of money. They were making lots of money based off the success that they had. And they just squandered everything. You know, young players haven't, over the last decade or so, no young player really has come through. They kind of lost faith in their La Masia academy. They squandered loads of money on players. Like Griezmann, they spent 120 million on. Then they loaned him back to Atletico last summer. Coutinho came on last night for his first start in about a year. He was pretty awful. Dembele, they spent another 100 million on as well. He's been injured again. He's always injured. And you know, the players like Luke de Jong, who they signed, a striker who was Sevilla, backup striker who they signed at the last minute in the window. And Barca fans are going, like, this isn't our club. This isn't our team. But it is the reality at the minute. And as you say, like, they are, instead of like fighting to win the Champions League this season, the fight is now to try and get back into it next year. And the way things are going at the minute, you wouldn't bet on them.
Dermot, are Barcelona fans, like, I don't know how, I guess, patient fans in Spain are compared to fans in England or even in Ireland here. Like, to look around the Nou Camp last night and see the empty seats, and I know there's still, I think, a cap on maybe 30,000 fans allowed in stadiums, and but there was still, you know, 3,000 or 4,000 less than that in the Nou Camp last night. For a stadium like that, the size of it, to see as many empty seats was quite disarming. I mean, are Barcelona fans just not showing up at the moment, or what's the attitude?
Yeah, Barca is a unique club in a way in how connected a lot of the fans are to the club. You know, because so many of them are members of the club as well, the socios. A lot of them live around the area and go to the games. A lot of the kind of the most, I call them senior socios, but the people who've been there all the way through are there. And I wasn't there last night, but I was at the Bayern game last week. And again, you know, it was Bayern were coming, but they didn't sell out, even within the limitations from COVID. You know, a lot of seats were still left empty. And during the game, there was this kind of debate going on, or it felt like there was a debate going on amongst the fans. There are lots of them who are like, you know, we are Barca, we need to play a certain way. They don't even mind, or they say anyway, they don't mind losing, but they need to play with their own style. And that would mean, you know, playing the same tactics as you used to play under Guardiola. It would mean using a lot of players from the youth system who've grown up playing the same style, playing the tiki-taka kind of idea that they kind of know it ingrained in themselves. And they might not be the best players in the world, but they'll, when they all come together and play together, they can play above themselves and they can give a good show. And if it's not good enough to beat Bayern, then that's okay. But it would have been good enough to beat Granada, say, last night. There are others, and Koeman is definitely in this, who say they're more pragmatic and more realistic about it. And they say, look, we don't have the players to play that way anymore. This is modern football has changed. You need different characteristics in players. You can't get away with it the way they used to. And we need to sign, whether it's Luke de Jong or Aguero on a free transfer, or the other players that they've signed in recent years. And that kind of debate is really going on amongst the fans at the minute. That on both sides are very kind of, you know, they get very emotional about it. They get very committed to the debate. It gets very kind of difficult and strained. And then the team have to try and play within that atmosphere. Koeman isn't dealing with it very well. He's you know, coming out looking very upset. Laporta, the president, is, you know, very charismatic guy, or we know him as a very charismatic guy, but he's kind of struggling at the minute. Doesn't look like he has a plan to move forward. And, you know, it's just a kind of depressing situation for a lot of Barca fans at the minute.
Like, I know he has a lot of injury concerns at the moment, and that's fair enough. Probably a legitimate excuse when you see some of the names that are out. And he's been a bit unlucky, Koeman, in that regard. But is he a bit reluctant to play young players? Like, is there a Mourinho-esque kind of feel? I know there's kind of rumours in Spanish newspapers that he's almost being instructed to play some of these La Masia graduates and kind of reluctant to do it. Like, is that something that has followed Koeman around a bit, that he's maybe a little bit more reluctant to play some of the Barcelona youngsters than maybe perhaps some other managers would be?
Again, there's a debate about that. If you ask Koeman himself, he will say that, look, I put in Pedri last year. Pedri, you know, was signed by Barca just over 12 months ago, came from Segunda Division side Las Palmas, was 17, you know, fitted into the team straight away. And Koeman had trust in him. And then we saw Pedri at the Euros last summer, how quickly he advanced. There, you know, last night he gave a league debut, La Liga debut, to a 17-year-old left-back, Balde, who looks a good player. He brought on Gavi, another 17-year-old. He says, look, I am showing faith in these young players. The contra view to that is that he doesn't have faith in the model of Barcelona, that the way that Barcelona need to play. And all these young players have been brought up playing the same way, and Koeman brings them into the team and then asks them to do something completely different that they're not used to. And there are some people who say that he doesn't really have faith in the young players, but he's using it as a shield for himself, saying, look, I'm putting in these young guys. You have to be patient. I'm the one who's showing faith in La Masia. But then not everybody believes that. So again, as with everything at Barca, there's a huge debate around it. People spend a lot of time talking about it, arguing about it, while at the same time the team is getting worse and worse.
Who is the potential successor that's obvious? Is there one already in the club, or would this be the time where they're asking one of the former legends to come back and essentially save the club? Because it feels like they're too broke at the moment to sack Koeman, but Koeman's not there for the long term.
Yeah, Koeman, like last summer, at the end of last season, Barca won the Copa del Rey last season, but then their La Liga campaign fell away, kind of ironically enough, with a loss to Granada, who they were playing again last night. And Laporta very clearly declined to give Koeman a vote of confidence. Spent about 2 weeks looking around to see who else could come in. Xavi Hernandez, who everybody knows is going to be a Barca coach at some stage, who's in Qatar at the moment, was there. I'm pretty sure would have taken over the job. Laporta decided against it. Had a look at other people who were around, like Allegri, people at that kind of level who are, you know, renowned coaches around Europe, but who don't have Barca DNA, as they say, and then decided to stick with Koeman when he couldn't find a better replacement, because Barca don't have money. You know, people are talking about Antonio Conte, who, you know, a coach with a huge track record of, or a big track record of success, but who always demands lots of money and lots of power from the board, who wants to sign lots of players, and Barca just can't do that. It looks like the bridges have been burned a bit with Xavi, and Xavi's in Qatar, and I don't see him coming back at the minute. The purists around Barca would have appointed the Barca B coach last year, who is Garcia Pimienta, who's a former Barca player from the 1990s, his career was cut short by injuries, and he spent about 15 years in La Masia, working his way up from the very bottom up to the Barça B, and did well with them, developed a lot of the young players who they'd like to see come in. But he was sacked last summer by Laporta, who put in Sergi, the left-back from Koeman's former teammate. He could take over maybe as a replacement, but then he doesn't have a great record coaching in La Liga. Jordi Cruyff is around the club. He came back into the club last summer and is in a kind of advisory role to Laporta. But Cruyff says he won't take over from Koeman. He's gone on the record to say, Koeman's my friend. I know him very well. I'm not here to take his job. So it's kind of in a situation where everybody knows that Koeman isn't the best coach for Barca at the minute, that both within and outside the club, they prefer somebody else to come in. But the situation is that they can't find somebody or can't afford somebody or can't attract somebody to take over from. So it's kind of a limbo situation at the minute.
Okay. A quick word about the situation at Real Madrid, because obviously Real Madrid have had their own fairly similar political issues and some financial issues, but nowhere near as bad, it seems, certainly publicly, as Barcelona's. And yet they've been able to produce a winning side, and some of their young players are starting to emerge as the genuine superstars that we thought they might be. Vinicius in particular is in great form at the moment. So I suppose with everything, they're always comparing each other to each other, and certainly Real Madrid have the upper hand at the moment.
Yeah, Madrid fans are very happy at the minute, both on both counts, to see Barca struggling and for things to be going Madrid's way. Ancelotti has come back to the club again. Ancelotti wasn't everybody's maybe first choice to replace Zidane when Zidane left again last summer, but is a kind of safe pair of hands, knows the club really well, was happy to come back, is willing to work within the restrictions that the finances and the work with Florentino Perez, and he's doing the best he can with what he has. But they haven't been playing very well at all. They've been quite lucky maybe in games, but then the kind of Madrid way, or what they say, is that we don't have to play brilliantly all the way through. We don't have to play like Barca, but at the end we'll find a way to win the game. They did it in Milan last week at Inter in the Champions League, and again at the weekend at Valencia, were outplayed for most of the game, but Vinicius and Benzema scored, and Vinicius has been amazing. 5 goals in 5 games this season, after 5 goals in 59 games leading up to that, which is, we'll have to see whether that run can continue. But again, it's Ancelotti. He's able to relax people, to give confidence, to get them just comfortable in themselves. He's done a great job with Vinicius, and just generally, compared to Koeman, who's fighting with people, who's upset, fans are upset with him, Barca, everybody is at each other's throats. Ancelotti comes in, calms everything down, gets the team playing in a recognisable way, trusts in the quality of his players, and it's true also they just have better players than Barca at the minute.
I just wanted to ask you before we wrap about Leo Messi being subbed off by Mauricio Pochettino. None of us are used to seeing this. None of us are used to seeing him on the bench at any stage, really. What has the perception of that move been like so far in Spain, and what do you think?
It's like Pochettino hadn't studied Messi's career at all up until now. Former Barca coaches, all of them learned very, very quickly that you have to play Messi whenever he wants to play. Even Pep Guardiola, Luis Enrique, guys who won Champions Leagues with Messi at certain times, learned what happens if you leave him out of the team, even if it seems to be for his own good, to avoid injury or because he's tired or whatever, or just needs a rest. And Messi always just needed to play. It was surprising to see Pochettino do it. I guess maybe Pochettino feels that he needs to keep everybody happy in the squad or maybe, motivate Messi or whatever, but it's a dangerous way to go down. It hasn't worked out well for any Barca coach who tried to do it in the past. And I imagine just from looking at the images of Messi's face and just what went on there, that it's going to be a tricky one for Pochettino to manage in the future.
It seems like it's a pissing contest, and the world global superstar, who's the greatest footballer of all time, I would suspect will tend to win those.
Yeah, that's what has always happened at Barcelona. There were many within Barcelona who wondered if Messi, just because of exactly what we're talking about here, if it was maybe better for him not to be there anymore, considering the work that they need to do, that there's always so much that comes with having Messi around. He's been amazing. He scores an amazing amount of goals. Even in recent years, he reinvented himself as more of a playmaker, but also got lots of goals as well. And you just kind of have to live with what he brings you outside of that, with the personality that he has and the difficulties in man management that are there. Barca, there were people, and there are still people who wonder whether everything was stage managed last summer in order to move him out without it rebounding too badly on Laporta or on Koeman. And they're now looking at it going like, well, this is Paris Saint-Germain's problem now and Pochettino's problem now, and happy that they're not having to deal with it.
It turns out they can't, or they certainly aren't dealing with it very well so far. Dermot, good stuff. Thanks a million. Cheers.
Thanks, Tom.
Dermot Corrigan, give us his thoughts there. Right, OTBAM brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. Here's what's coming up on OTB Sports Radio today. OTB Sports Radio is there all day, every day for you, by the way. If you want a little bit of company at 1 o'clock, it's OTB Gold. Barry Ryan's book, The Ascent. Dadcast from 3. Career Retrospective with Matt Holland at 4. And OTB Gold is The Life and Times of Johnny Kilbane at 6. Left Ackle as a kid, went to Cleveland, and was one of the longest reigning world champions in boxing ever. Somebody that Mike Tyson would have name checked when he was showing off his knowledge of boxing history. So another Ackle emigrant called Kilbane, who went off and had a pretty good career for himself. So that's at 6, and I'm being told here it's Kilbane, but I don't think it is.
Tomato, tomato, Jared, it's all good.
I mean, there were Kilbanes were our neighbours when we were kids, and that's why I would have got Kev's name wrong when I started, until obviously it got corrected. But I would have said this. All right.
We'll ask Kev. Kev Kilbane. It's Kev Kilbane. Let's just say Johnny Kilbane. You know, we're not going to get crucified.
Tommy Rooney's crucifying me here, saying I've got it wrong. He's one of those Ackles. Anyway, look, sure look. You live and learn. Every day's a school day. 12 minutes past 9 this morning. Up next, we're going to talk with author and creator of Russell Carroll Kelly, Paul Howard, to talk about his new book, Normal Sheeple.
OTB AM.
It's 13 minutes past 9. Now, the latest chapter in the Russell Carroll Kelly saga is out now. It's published by Penguin. Normal Sheeple sees the King of South Dublin relocate to rural Kerry, and it's already another hit. And I'm delighted to say author Paul Howard is with us this morning. Paul, good morning to you. How are you?
Brilliant. Fantastic.
So
great to be here.
The front cover is obviously Ross in an Anguille Talks jersey, I believe, but it also nicely, it could also be a River Plate jersey. So maybe there's a series where he goes to Argentina and Buenos Aires after this.
I when I saw that jersey first, I thought of Peru in 1978. So I'm probably, 4 years older than you? it's like the old Peru jersey. We put a lot of thought into this cover. I mean, there's clearly a kind of normal people thing going on. You know, he looks like Connell with the hair. He's got the fringe. And if you look really, really closely, he's got the chain with a little kind of fungi on the end of it. But the jersey was the big thing. And it was about getting that right, because I think it's been a shock to a lot of people to see Ross on the cover of a Ross book wearing anything other than the Leinster rugby jersey or the Ireland rugby jersey. So it was about getting the artwork right. I think Alan Clark has done an amazing job with it. He draws all of the covers of the books and the illustrations inside. But it's kind of a new departure for Ross, because he's never played Gaelic football before, and he's always sort of considered Gaelic football to be for people who are, you know, too stupid to understand the laws of rugby.
I was going to say, this is definitely treading new ground. Up to this point, I suspect that you would have had a lot of GAA fans who are happy to laugh knowingly at all the rugby jokes. Now, all of a sudden, the mirror is being turned on them. And how has that experience been for those people?
Well, from what I've heard, they've laughed at it so far. I know I've had some contact from Anguille Talked GA Club, who are delighted that Ross chose them of all clubs to play for. But it sort of happened quite by accident. You know, he was bringing his daughter Honor to the Gael Talked, the Jail Talked, as she calls it. And he's utterly convinced that she won't last more than 24 hours on the Dingle Peninsula, once she finds out she has no easy access to Starbucks and she doesn't have more than one bar of mobile phone coverage. But to his great surprise, she decides after 24 hours that she actually likes it and wants to stay. And to it, Ross's even greater surprise, he discovers the same thing about himself. And he's driving, through the Dingle Peninsula one day, and a ball hits the windscreen of his car. And he gets out, and he picks it up, and it's not a, as he says himself, it's not a normal shaped ball. This one is round. And some people start shouting at him to kick the ball back, and he kicks it back, and they're blown away by the length he manages to get into the kick. And it turns out that this is Anguiltaught's veteran GAA team. So they're kind of over 50-year-old footballers, and they have a grudge match coming up against Sneem. And they ask Ross, they sort of bring him in first for a training session, and they discover that, you know, all of the skills that made Ross a great rugby player, you know, the kicking and the high catching, can be equally applied to Gaelic football. And, you know, what it takes them a good sort of 16 to 17 hours to explain the rules of the game to him. He discovers that he's quite good at it. And without giving the end away, he becomes fully engaged in this grudge match. He's well used to grudge matches, having played, you know, so many against Blackrock and Belvo and Clongowes. But this kind of regional grudge match, like one village or one region against another, is something he's completely new to.
Is there anything in particular, Paul, that draws Ross to Kerry specifically? Like, there's a reason that he doesn't go to, I don't know, some rural part of Donegal or Galway or Cork? Like, is the this cute her kind of Healy Ray mentality down there? Is there something in the water down there specifically about Kerry that draws him down?
I don't know. I mean, he struggles with the accent. Like, Ross is, you know, once Ross kind of goes anywhere south of the Loughlinstown roundabout, absolutely everybody sounds like Peg Sayers to him. So all of the, you know, all of the language is kind of, it's like that John Millington Synge way of writing dialogue. You know, that's what Ross hears when he hears Kerry people speak. I don't know I think it's kind of just an accident that Honor happened to be going to that Gaeltacht. The cool Gaeltacht, I'm told, are in Donegal and in Galway. And Honor leaves it too late to book. So she's kind of a loner. She's sent on her own down to Kerry. And so that was just quite by accident.
How do you think this character, Paul, has endured and survived for so long? I think it's 23 years now, if I'm not mistaken. Like, he probably started off as quite an unlikable character per Ross. And he's kind of come around a bit. We're all warming to him slightly. Is that part of the, I guess, the longevity of his character?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, when I look back on the early books, I put a book of columns together this year. So it was like 23 years of Ross O'Carroll Kelly columns in a book. And when I was reading the early columns, it was kind of interesting to me because it was quite clear looking back on them that I actually didn't like Ross for probably the first 5 years that I was writing the column. I actively disliked this stereotype, you know, this rugby jock type of character, who I'd seen quite a lot of in my own kind of childhood and youth, you know, these sort of privileged rugby jock characters. And I think over the course of 20 years of writing it, I have warmed to him. I mean, you can't write about a character for that long without developing some kind of understanding and some kind of empathy for him. But the strange thing is, somebody pointed out to me recently that in the early Ross books, Ross was the least likable character. And in the last sort of four or five books, he seems to be the only sensible character, that everybody around him has kind of lost their mind. You know, his father is the Taoiseach now, and, you know, he's establishing links with Vladimir Putin and trying to take Ireland out of the EU. His wife, Surika, is the Minister for Climate Action, and she's trying to ban cows and sheep in Ireland. She's trying to kind of wipe out the breeds because of the, you know, the harmful gases. So everybody's kind of lost their moral compass a little bit. And Ross, it has kind of just become an observer of this madness that's going on around him. And I think that's part of the reason people have kind of started to like him. You know, I think he's kind of, he is, in a lot of ways, he's sort of become the straight man watching other people's madness.
On a personal level, have you found it more difficult to be creative over the last few years when you haven't been trying to scratch the itch of the gaping hole of Liverpool's failure in your life? All of a sudden, that bit of your life has been fulfilled. And surely that makes life far more difficult for you as a creator.
Yeah. Well, look, last year, I have to say last year was the most productive year of my career, and that was the year when I kind of rediscovered suffering, you know, as a Liverpool fan, you know, watching what kind of happened to Liverpool between the start of January and the end of the season. And it's probably not a coincidence that, you know, I did more work then. I was more productive then in those months. But, having followed Liverpool as a kid, and, you know, it's no coincidence that I, you know, I chose Liverpool because I was 6 years old when they won the first European Cup in 1977. So I was allowed to stay up late to watch Liverpool. So they were my team as a child and into my teenage years. And a lot of Man United fans will know how this feels. You don't ever see a day when your team is not going to be successful, when you're going to know what it just feels like to, you know, just sort of shrug and say, that's what it means to be a Liverpool fan, you know. And, you know, having suffered through like the Roy Hodgson years, for instance, you know, I sort of came to a point where I just thought I will never see a successful Liverpool team again in my lifetime. So, you know, the Jurgen Klopp years have just been, you know, just an unexpected twist in my life.
Is there a weird sense of how tenuous it is now that it could easily revert back to a Roy Hodgson style era, that it's all completely bound up? It seems essentially in Klopp's genius.
Yeah, but I don't think Klopp is going anywhere. I've heard a lot of people say, oh, well, he's going to take the Bayern Munich job and then he's going to take the Germany job. And, I think he's quite happy there. I don't see that ending. I see a lot of really exciting things happening at Liverpool. Like, you know, I know Liverpool fans, they're quite excitable and quite neurotic. And, you know, having suffered through 30 years, I think that's kind of understandable. But, you know, when Liverpool don't sign players, it's suddenly seen as, you know, this is the end of a great era for Liverpool. But I kind of see progress in the really boring stuff, like that fans don't want to know about, like, you know, signing players up on new deals. You know, they're not sexy news stories that grab headlines, like signing Ronaldo or Lukaku or Jack Grealish. But this is Liverpool for the next 5 years now, you know, giving new deals to, you know, Alisson, Fabinho, Henderson, Andy Robertson, Trent Alexander-Arnold. Like it's paperwork stuff. So fans don't get excited about it, but it's a sign that Liverpool are no longer a selling club. And that's what's sort of killed Liverpool over the last, especially kind of the 10 years before Klopp came in. You know, you remember, you know, Torres, Alonso, Mascherano, Coutinho, these players who should have been building blocks for Liverpool, you know, the players you build a great team around. But as soon as a good offer came in for them, they were gone. And I kind of think that's not happening anymore. You know, there's some players are signing up to longer deals. There's lots of reasons for that. You know, the financial collapse of Spanish football, especially Barcelona and Real Madrid, not being in a position to sign players. So players aren't being, you know, they're not being enticed to go abroad anymore. But I think that stuff is really, really exciting. But it's kind of hard because, you know, fan websites don't talk a lot about players getting new contracts.
Well, one of the things, I suppose, Paul, that I've noticed you even talking on Twitter about it as well, is a couple of things, like for example, the yellow card a player gets when he takes off his shirt after scoring, or even, and I think the way you phrased it was this fetishization of numbers, like the XG, the expected goals amongst fans and fan forums at the moment. Like, is modern football enjoyable for you, or does all this kind of nonsense maybe make it a little less enjoyable than it used to be?
Yeah, I mean, I can switch that stuff off. I mean, I mock the XG thing all the time. I just know that a lot of my friends who were into the XG thing aren't really into football. They're kind of numbers people more than football fans. Even things like assists really annoy me because, you know, like the most decisive move in any particular goal, it might not be involve the second last player to touch the ball. It could be an extraordinary through pass. I was looking at a goal last night. I think it was Dirk Kuyt's first goal for Liverpool. And
as you do.
Yeah. As you do. I was looking back on the, you know, the glory days, and Xabi Alonso plays this extraordinary pass that's almost like a golf putt right to the feet of Steve Finnan, who crosses the ball for Kuyt to score from, you know, 6 yards out. So Steve Finnan, if assists had been a thing at the time, which, you know, mercifully they weren't, Steve Finnan would have got the assist. But the genius is in Xabi Alonso's pass. And this pass is just extraordinary. It's worth having a look at it, you know. It curls. Like, it is like a golf putt. He curled this pass on the ground. And that's the reason Liverpool scored the goal. So that just, things like that just make a nonsense of the whole notion of assists. I think of Maradona's great goal against England in 1986, the second one. I mean, who got the assist for that? Like, sometimes there isn't an assist, and sometimes the assist is four passes back, the real assist. I think this stuff has been brought in to facilitate gambling and to facilitate fantasy football. And I think there, you know, people who are into those two things get utterly obsessed with those things. I saw Liverpool fans on a forum last weekend, and quite a few of them in my Twitter feed talking about how many shots at goal Liverpool had against AC Milan inside the box as opposed to outside the box. Like, you know, like this is somehow relevant. And, you know, having gone to football all my life, like I never remember leaving a match excited by how many shots at goal we had inside or outside the box. Like, those things are just utterly meaningless. To me, it's about the results, you know, it's about the score.
Can I just bring you back just 1 second to something you said a moment ago, Paul, about last year being the most productive of your career? Like, it strikes me, and correct me if I'm wrong here, that this is the Norma Sheeple is the third of four books I think you're involved in coming out this year. Like, the pandemic for a lot of people, I suppose, gave us an opportunity to kind of sit back and reflect and do things we didn't have time to do. So clearly that time period for you has been remarkably productive.
Yeah, I mean, I'm here in Avoca in Wicklow, and we, you know, for the start of the pandemic, we couldn't go more than, what was it, 2 kilometres from the house, and there's not a lot to do, you know, within 2 kilometres of my house here. So I was stuck here, you know, socially, like, couldn't see anyone. So I had quite a few deadlines at the time. So it was, you know, in a sort of perverse way, it was a godsend to me, because I didn't have to live a life outside of work. So, you know, I get up early to work. So I was kind of, you know, I was up at, you know, 5 o'clock every morning and work until 5 o'clock every evening. So I did sort of 12-hour days for a year. But I had a huge amount of work to do last year. I was working with Gordon Darcy on his the children's series we've been doing together, and we've just finished the third one, which is out next month, and which is about where Gordon goes and plays for the Lions. But it was great to have that work, because, you know, I think there's only so much time of every day I could spend on the internet looking up, you know, old Dirk Kuyt goals for Liverpool.
So what's next?
I'm actually sitting down today. I have a piece of paper in front of me, and it just says Ross Book 22 storylines. And so I'm starting to plot next year's book. I'm starting to plot the follow up to Normal Sheeple. And so it's a year out, but it's just, for me, it's just process. You know, like, this is what I do in September every year. I'll spend a week working at the storylines. I'll send them to Rachel Pierce, my editor, and we'll have a discussion over several weeks over, you know, what should go into the next book. And then I'll come up with a beat by beat plot. It sounds quite boring, but that's what I do for every book. And then Lion's Roar, the next book in the Gordon's Game series, is out on the 14th of October, I think. So that's exciting as well.
Next year, obviously, is the 20th anniversary of Saipan. Will you dust down Gaffers and give us a reanimated version, a revisited version?
I don't know. There's just been so much about Saipan over the years. You know, at the 5th anniversary, the 10th anniversary, the 20th anniversary is coming up. You know, I know we had the 20th anniversary recently of Ireland against Holland at Lansdowne Road, the 1-0 win that really kind of took that team to the World Cup in 2002. For me, that's much more interesting. For me, that's much more of a sort of unexplored story. I would love to sit down with Louis van Gaal and watch that match and just talk to him about it and talk to him about his decisions, why he put four strikers on at the end and resorted to the long ball. I think that stuff is fascinating. I kind of think the Saipan thing is burned out a little bit. I don't think there's even any nostalgia value in it at the moment. After all these years,
we're dead. We're dead inside. Essentially, is the problem.
Well, I think we cared too much at the time that it's very difficult to care enough 20 years later.
Thankfully, we've moved on, I hope. Paul, good stuff. Congratulations on the book and thanks a million for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me on. Thank you.
No worries. It's called Normal Sheeple and it is available in all good bookshops and online now. And it's the continuing story of Ross O'Carroll Kelly down in Angoyltocht. I want to tell you about this. The OTB Roadshows are back alongside Cadbury Ireland. We're going to be bringing interviews with some legends of the Premier League. Next up, this is a big one for you, Shane. It's for all the Man United fans. Legendary defender Jaap Stam joins us. We'll speak to kitman Albert Morgan and Stephanie Roach, who is a Manchester United superfan. Get the OTB Sports app and keep an eye on our channels this week for more information. It's all with thanks to the hashtag Cadbury FC. All right, we're going to hear from Fiona Coughlan on the latest in Irish rugby before 10. But first, yesterday marked 10 years since this.
My favourite superhero would be Batman, of course. He's got all the toys, he's got all the cars, and gets the girls too.
That was awesome.
Superpower, you know, I guess teleport session will be great. You know, we travel a lot on the golf tour. If I could get myself to Asia or Australia or somewhere in the world in an instant, I would save some time.
Tattoos, no
tattoos. Definitely not in the near future either. I'm not a tattoo kind of guy. My biggest fear, probably snakes. Alligators, spiders, yikes.
Biggest weakness, probably a cold beer. I just can't resist them.
Typical date night for me, probably dinner and a movie. Definitely dinner somewhere, dinner and drinks, something on those lines. Some hobbies outside of golf. I'm a big sport fan, I love all sports, mainly football, British football, soccer as you guys like to call it. Big Manchester United fan. I just like hanging out, really. You know, golf's such a busy life out there. You know, just sports, TV, going to the events, movies. Just hanging out, really, you know. Just love to come home and chill out, have a couple of cold beers and relax. Well, sportsmen, we're pretty superstitious guys, you know. I like to have certain things in line before I go to the golf course. I only use my white tees, my lucky white tees. Got my off the ball tees here. My lucky marker. But I've just gotta, everything's gotta be in line before I go to the golf course. So pretty superstitious guys as golfers. If I wasn't a golfer, what would I be? Broke. Nobody ever really asks me my favourite book. You know, there's so many to choose from. A lot of the hipsters choose Ulysses, James Joyce, something along those lines. But you know, for me, it's a pretty easy, simple choice. Killa, it's the autobiography of Kevin Kilbane. 110 caps for the Republic of Ireland, and most recently a star of Dancing on Ice. Twinkle Toast, I think we call them. Y'all come back now, you hear? I think Boo Weekly would be proud of me there.
Yeah, awesome work, Shane. Happy birthday as well. Big 3-0 today, is it?
No, Jesus, Jerry, you're putting a couple of years on me. 20th today, thanks very much. So still young, myself and Tommy Rooney still holding down the fort for the youngsters in the office.
No longer mid-20s, Shane. That's very definitely, definitively late 20s, so, you know.
It's kind of scary when you see 30 in your front mirror, but look, there's still some older lads in the office, Jerry. I won't point any fingers. So keeps us feeling young at least. So 28's the new 23, I think. So I'm not too worried just yet. Still in the prime of my life, Jerry.
Absolutely. As we will no doubt learn over the next couple of weeks when we get cracking on our duathlon. This week is the European Week of Sport, by the way, which aims to promote sport and physical activity in all countries right across Europe. It's for everyone, regardless of age, background or fitness level. With a focus on grassroots initiatives, the aim is to inspire Europeans to hashtag be active on a regular basis and create opportunities in your everyday lives to exercise more. To celebrate all this week and off the ball from 7 o'clock each night, we're going to be giving away a €100 Sport Ireland campus voucher every evening, as well as an overall prize, which includes a family coaching session with some former Olympians at the facility, as well as behind-the-scenes tour of the Sport Ireland campus and much more. So be sure to tune in tonight for that. OTBAM is brought to you by Gillette. Good morning, start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. Tomorrow morning, Kenny Cunningham back in studio. Our big Ryder Cup preview with John Duggan. There's football with Nathan, and Paul McGrath is going to join us as well.
OTB AM with Gillette. Put your best face forward with our new and improved razors.